with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome to the program. It's a little more than a minute past the hour. I'm Bob. This is The Horn. And sorry for missing prayer meeting, but you know what? I was busy. But I have good news. For those of you who didn't catch the tweets or the Facebooking, Agnes got through the surgery just fine, and she is home. Brought her home earlier today. She is on industrial strength pain medication. She is uncomfortable, but she's home and happy to be here. And especially tickled and pleased and warmed in the heart by all the good wishes that all of you sent along. The Facebook page got pretty doggone long, and that's awfully nice of you. And thanks for the emails and kind wishes that way. Thanks for the phone calls and the kind wishes we've received there. Thanks to the two of you, who you know who you are, who sent flowers. See, Agnes puts forward this rough and tumble and take-no-prisoners kind of personality attitude, but like I've warned you before, she's a marshmallow. And flowers? Oh, flowers are kryptonite to Agnes's mean streak. So when the flowers arrive today, suffice to say, she wept. She'll kill me if she hears me saying that. But she did. She wept. So thank you, all of you. Your kindness and your good wishes made all of this a lot less of an unpleasant experience for her than it otherwise would have done. And you know what? That matters. I know, you know, we don't all adhere to any particular holy book, but I think a lot of us do take to heart the common sense that many of the sacred texts around the world, focused as they are on various and sundry imaginary beings, manage to eke out. And there's no magic involved when the guy who said, love your neighbor as yourself, and got murdered by the state for it, they said, what is the greatest commandment? And he said, love God with all your heart. And what's the second commandment? And Jesus made up a wholly new commandment that wasn't even in the list. He said, love your neighbor as yourself. So later on, when he's giving the speech about the fact that, I was in prison and you visited me. I was hungry and you fed me. I was naked and you clothed me. And if you've done that to the least of these, you've done it also unto me. That's common sense. It's common sense decency. And you guys manifested it in such wonderful ways, in such good thoughts, in such good spirits, that it's inspiring to, it was inspiring to witness. A beautiful thing indeed. So, thank you. Thank you, all of you. You know, it occurs to me, and now we get to the meat of the program. It occurs to me that just like people, words can be overworked. And when words get overworked, they become less effective and less efficient and less existentially meaningful, just like people. If you work somebody to, if you work somebody to death, they can't work anymore. If you work someone past the point of their exhaustion, their work no longer has meaning. And so the same is true, I think, of language. And we throw words around, and I'm guilty of it as much as the next guy. We throw words around, never understanding, perhaps, that we are exhausting the words. Where an exhausted human simply collapses, an exhausted word becomes trite. Or it becomes cliched. That's really the definition of an exhausted word, isn't it? Trite or cliched. And so it is with one word that I've been thinking about since I read a story earlier today and decided to lead with it on the program. That word is poison. You know, there was a hair band in the 80s named Poison. Wasn't there? Yes, I do believe so. Do I have any poison? Yeah, there's some. No, different poison. But the word poison occurred to me how much we overwork it. And what I, you know, we talk about, she had to get away from him. She was in a poisonous relationship. We talk about poisonous snakes. And that's the, you know, and that's one of the true meanings of it, poison dart. But we talk about poison politics. Oh, God, there's a band name. We talk about, please. He's just poison. Wherever he goes, things just go wrong. He's poison. But there is a real meaning of poison. The real dictionary definition of poison is a substance that causes injury, illness, or death, especially by chemical means. Second definition, something destructive or fatal. And the etymology is Latin. Potio. The act of drinking, a drink or a draught, as of a medicine or a poison. And it's also the root word of potion. Why is it I feel like Eugene Finnerman should be doing this instead of me? He's much better at this kind of thing. But poison is one of those words that we have a tendency perhaps to overwork. Oh, thank you, Marty. Yes, every rose has its thorn. Which kind of, I guess, works in with the idea of poison, doesn't it? In some way. And there it is. God, this is awful. Yeah. And the song, of course, was written about a toxic relationship that was breaking up between, what, Bret Michaels and his girlfriend or something.
We both lie silent still in the dead of the night. Although we both lie close together, we feel miles apart inside. Was it something I said or something I did my work?
Yeah, see, that's how something gets rendered trite. But in this case, in the case of where I want to go with the program this evening, no, real poison. The stuff like in the dictionary definition. I got to thinking about this earlier today when I saw a post over at Cold Tattoo. By Ken Ward, who is one of the greatest and best of the environmental writers in the entire United States, bar none. A post over at Coal Tattoo entitled, New Report Documents More Coal Ash Contamination. The Environmental Integrity Project, Earth Justice, and the Sierra Club today released a report that documents 39 additional coal ash dump sites in 21 states that are contaminating drinking water or surface water with arsenic and other heavy metals, Ken reports. Here's the interesting thing. Every one of the coal ash dump sites that had groundwater monitoring wells showed concentrations of heavy metals like arsenic and lead, and every well showed that the poisons, see, the real stuff, the poisons exceeded federal health-based standards for drinking water. Where are they? Well, let's see. Remember, this comes from coal ash. This is your water we're talking about. In many instances, this is coal ash that comes from coal that was mountaintop removed somewhere in Appalachia. Do you live in Arkansas? Do you live in Connecticut? How about Florida? Illinois, perhaps? Iowa? Kentucky? Louisiana? Michigan? Nevada? Nevada? You say tomato, I say tomato. Let's call the whole thing off, especially where the coal ash is concerned. New York, North Carolina, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma. Oklahoma, where the ash comes oozing out. Never mind. Oregon, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, Wisconsin. Those are all states that contain god-awful poison levels in groundwater directly attributable not to any other source, not to the fact that, you know, it just sits, that the aquifer sits on top of a concentration of lead. No. No. The water in parts of all of these states has been poisoned by coal ash, which is what's left over after the coal's been burned for the electricity that runs your computer or the lights that you leave on when you walk out of the room. Also, when you're in the room, but, you know, it's the stuff, it's the electricity that we use when we're not actually even using it that's really, really egregious and frustrating and maddening. Let's see, Hatfield's Ferry is a coal ash dumping ground in Pennsylvania. The groundwater well testing area that accompanies that particular coal ash dump has, you ready for this? 341 times the federal safe standard for arsenic. Kind of mind-boggling, isn't it? Even more so, and I'm not trying to get anybody down or ruin anybody's supper, it's kind of sickening, isn't it? See, these are just, these are 39 additional sites in the United States that are being poisoned by coal ash. I'm sure that somewhere in the bowels of the American Coal Ash Association, some PR flack is trying desperately to put a positive light on this. Well, increased arsenic concentrations means that fewer Americans will die of Alzheimer's. I think I got it, boss! No. There is nowhere in this country, just about, that isn't poisoned by coal ash, whether it be Massachusetts or New York or Virginia, Maryland, North Carolina, Georgia, South Carolina, Wisconsin. God, it goes on and on and on. Texas. You're not safe from it. To the extent that coal is burned in California, there's a coal ash waste facility somewhere, a coal ash dump, and that sucker's poisoning there as well. You see, there is nothing that is touched by coal that is not poisoned. And I want to be very, very careful in my use of that word. I don't mean that it makes the neighborhood less nice to live in. I don't mean that it might decrease your property values. I mean that the stuff gets in you and it does ungodly amounts of harm. You see, the entire coal cycle is poisonous from beginning to end. I've told you about what happens here in West Virginia with mountaintop removal. And what it does to the source streams and the headwater streams of the drinking water supplies of most of the eastern and southeastern United States is almost incalculable and unexpressible. It's part of the reason that a lot of us are going to go to Washington, D.C. On the weekend of the 25th through the 27th for Appalachia Rising. If you want to learn more about Appalachia Rising, you can go to appalacharising.org. At some point in time, probably before Appalachia Rising, the coal mob is going to have their Friends of Coal rally in D.C. too. Can you imagine that? I remember a long time when our buddy Alan said that he wanted to make a bumper sticker that said, coal's too dirty to be my friend. And it's the truth. It used to be when I would see somebody when I was driving around West Virginia here with one of those stupid little oval white stickers with the blue border and the blue and black letters, Friends of Coal, I'd get mad. I would get mad. And to a certain extent, I still do. But more and more, I just look at them and I think, how damned pathetically ignorant and stupid are you? Just plain stupid. Not ignorant. Ignorance can be cured. But as the old saying goes, there's none so blind as those who will not see. And those who could see but refuse to, those people are not ignorant. Those people are stupid. The study that I'm referring to today, that Ken Ward's post directed me to, and would direct you to if you wish to see it as well, it's over at wvgazette.com, and then just go to the Coal Tattoo blog. Introduces itself by saying, days before the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency kicks off a series of regional hearings across the United States on whether, see, that's the thing that drives me crazy, it's that word whether, and how to regulate toxic coal ash waste from coal-fired power plants. Really? Really? We're not sure if we should regulate toxic, poisonous coal ash waste from coal-fired power plants? We're not sure about it? We're asking whether we oughta? Well, no, we got too much regulation in the country here today, Mr. Kincaid. You see, we at the American Coal Ash Association believe that we can probably make something that will make either a wonderful dessert topping or a floor wax out of coal ash. Maybe both. Good and good for you. Because we're the American Coal Ash Association. See? I'm soaking in it. Weather to regulate? We've got to let American business do business, even if it means poisoning the entire country. Well, we've been given the business all right. But anyway, this new study identifies 39 additional coal ash dump sites in 21 states that are contaminating drinking water or surface water, or both, with arsenic and other heavy metals. And one of the things that the report documents is the fact that state governments are not adequately monitoring coal combustion waste disposal sites, otherwise known as toxic coal ash. ...341 times the federal standard for arsenic at Hatfield's Ferry in Pennsylvania. The total... And remember why this research had to be done. You'll recall that the Kingston coal ash disaster happened in December of 2008. It remains the biggest toxic spill in American history, including the BP disaster. And see, toxic coal ash is all the toxins that occur naturally in coal, as the book says, pressed down and shaken together, concentrated in one place. And something in excess of 4 billion gallons of that vile, poisonous stuff flowed down the Clinch River and into the Tennessee River, toxified an entire portion of East Tennessee that may never actually be truly clean. And after it happened, to the extent that it got some news coverage, because it disappeared off the radar behind Lindsay Lohan or some pop star somewhere, something quicker than you can say Britney Spears' upskirt. A few people did ask questions, like, gee, how many more of these are there? And the response of the federal government was, we're not telling. National security. Yeah, that's it. National security. You don't need to know. If you needed to know, we'd tell you. So outside groups took it upon themselves to find them. With the 39 additional sites identified in today's report from the Environmental Integrity Project, Earth Justice, and Sierra Club, the total number of known, see, again, words are important, known, because there are still some that aren't, the total number of known toxic contamination sites from coal ash pollution is standing now at 137 in 34 states. I've already told you what the states are. This is serious business. ...29% of approximately 467 plants that dispose of coal ash on-site or off-site are part of these 137 that are creating such damage. Monitoring data and public information on private well locations near the following dump sites indicate that the contaminated groundwater with all those heavy metals in the case of at least 15 of the 39 sites, is, yeah, getting into private water, private well water. Independence, Arkansas, Lansing, Michigan, Joliet 9 in Illinois, Cayuga, New York, Cardinal, Ohio, Muskingum, Ohio, Gavin, Ohio, Uniontown, Ohio, Northeastern Oklahoma, Boardman, Oregon, Bruce Mansfield, Pennsylvania, Hatfields Ferry, Pennsylvania, Big Stone, South Dakota, Oak Creek, Wisconsin, and Fayette Power in Texas. And with regard to at least 8 of those sites, there are 25 or more private drinking water wells at or within 2 miles of the various poisonous sites. In the Uniontown, Ohio, and Joliet 9 sites in Illinois, there are 90 or more private drinking water wells within a mile of these concentrated areas of manifest poison. Of the 39 identified in the report today, at least 18 are located within 5 miles of a public groundwater well. Those are in Flint Creek, Arkansas, Montville, Connecticut, Lansing, Iowa, George Neal, North Iowa, George Neal, South Iowa, Big Cajun, Louisiana, Dan River, North Carolina, Cardinal, Ohio, and Fayette Power Project, Texas. And it's not just the wells, it's the surface waters. The Hatfields Ferry, Pennsylvania site flows into the Nongahela River. And it's less than a half a mile away. The same same or similar is true of TVA's Shawnee, Kentucky, Gallatin, and Johnsonville, Tennessee sites along the Ohio, Cumberland, and Tennessee rivers. The Big Cajun and Lansing, Big Cajun, Louisiana, and Lansing, Iowa sites are along the Mississippi River. This report is detailed, and if you take time to give it any thought, terrifying. And this isn't all just old contamination. Most of the sites surveyed are still active, and virtually all of them show recent evidence of contamination. There is also evidence to suggest that there is illegal open dumping going on. Now, this list is spookiest, perhaps, of all. Because in these states, some of the most, the highest amount of coal ash generation is taking place. Alabama, Arizona, Georgia, Indiana, Ohio, Mississippi, Missouri, New Mexico, and Tennessee. Those are just a few. And each one of the states I just named require no monitoring whatsoever at coal ash dumps. Most coal ash dump sites in Texas are exempt from any regulation or monitoring by state officials. This sentence from the report: states whose regulations fail to require monitoring at ash ponds, both old and new, accounted for approximately 70% of the coal combustion waste generated nationwide in 2008. 70%. 75% of waste ponds are over 25 years old. 10% are over 50 years old. Scratch your head and consider what that means for you, for your friends, for your neighbors, your children, grandchildren, your dreams of progeny, nameless and unimagined down the centuries. This is very real. And these hearings about these hearings about coal ash that are being held by the Environmental Protection Agency are going to be taking place all over the country. It is worth your efforts It is worth your efforts to seek them out. My God. Gallatin and Johnsonville in Tennessee, as well as Hatfield's Ferry in Pennsylvania. All three of these coal ash dump sites are leaking into rivers, be it the Monongahela, the Cumberland, or the Tennessee. Almost immediately upstream of the intakes for public water systems that provide drinking water for tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of unsuspecting human beings. Now, I don't know about you, but I find that almost more than, well, let's put it this way. That is scarier to me. That is scarier to me than any horror movie that Hollywood could concoct. Zombies? Nah. Guys with hockey masks and chainsaws? Forget it. Big razor blade fingernails? Sorry. Coal scares the crap out of me because it's real. And it's not coming to a city near you. It's already there. This isn't, this isn't pod people. This isn't, you know, something under the bed. It's already in you. And it's already working on you. And understand that it's already in you and it's already working on you for no other reason save the fact that regardless of whether it be Patriot or Arch, Peabody or Massey, Consol, whomever, it's all there only because coal companies exist for one reason and one reason only, to make a buck. We've had the technology for decades now. We could be transitioning away from coal. It can't, and the thing is, it can't happen overnight. It has to happen over time. But every day that we wait is another sick child. Every day that we wait is another 12-year-old with teeth dissolving in her head because she brushes her teeth every night like Mama says she's supposed to. Only instead of preserving her teeth, the coal filth dissolves it like it does in southern West Virginia. Coal is toxic in its extraction, it is toxic in its transportation, it is toxic in its combustion, and it is toxic in its final ashen form. And yet the question posed by the Environmental Protection Agency is whether coal ash should be regulated? Whether? What kind of standard, what kind of balance, what's in the other pan of the scale that would make us ask whether the health of the citizens of the people and the people of the United States is important enough to regulate this monstrous poison? What's in that other pan? Don't tell anybody I said so, but I know. Money. Lots and lots of money. You see, this is part of something that we around here call the true cost of coal. It's something that we around here call the externalized cost of coal. Because Don Blankenship and Massey or Arch or Peabody, Patriot or Consol, none of them have to pay the costs associated with the unmitigated filth that they pump into your bodies. It was last week when we talked about Elbert Gervonta Woods, and his name is still with me, because I cannot forget him. And the coal companies killed him with the air that they breathe, and they are hard at work on you with the water that you drink. And they don't care. They do not care. The coal companies. All they care about is their quarterly profit and loss statement. And as long as that profit, the profit number is higher than the loss number, well, they're not going to count you or your loved ones in those losses. Because you don't exist. Because we are still waiting to determine whether something as foul, something as murderous, something as toxic, something as poison as coal ash should be regulated. And this is what I mean when I say we're all downstream. Oh, listen to Bob. He's always talking about that mountaintop removal. That's taking place in Appalachia. Lucky me. I live in Iowa. Lucky me. I live in Missouri. Lucky me. I live in Oregon. Lucky me, I live in Texas. Lucky me, I live in Oklahoma. Lucky me, I live in Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Connecticut, Michigan, Wisconsin. Lucky me, I don't have to worry about it. No, you don't have to, but you damned well better. So that's where we start the program this evening. 24 minutes before the hour, this is America's listener-supported liberal voice. Phone lines are open, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. This is The Horn.
No more folks, I deal with business.
17 minutes past or before the hour. At least it is here right now. Whatever time it is, if you're podcasting, you know, I don't know, but I can't be responsible for that part of the process. A couple of emails rolling in. Lucky Who from Cindy in Washington State. Oy vey, listen to Bob. You couldn't have a better friend warning you about a life-threatening danger. Coal is upstream of all of us. We need to quit using it, period. And we do. Because, see, it's kind of like, it's you know, like oil, it's a fossil fuel. It exists in finite quantities. And every time the coal industry says, oh, Jesus Christ, there's 750 years worth of coal in America. Lie. 500 years, lie. 250? Probably not. See, we've passed peak coal. You don't think about peak coal, do you? No, there's peak coal just like there's peak oil. And we've passed peak coal. That means here on out, the coal is going to get harder to get and more expensive to burn. And more toxic, too, because the good stuff is gone, if there ever was any. And the fact of the matter is, we've got to get away from it. Because if we don't get away from it, it's getting away from us. Now, Jim writes in and says, Bob, having identified a serious problem, notwithstanding that 46% of power in the U.S. is coal-produced, what are the immediate and long-term solutions? Well, one of the immediate solutions is to regulate this stuff and start cleaning, because everyone, understand, and I'm not directing this simply to Jim, you could make an argument that every one of these sites probably qualifies as something approaching a Superfund site. Another immediate solution is to start the process of eliminating the externalized cost of coal. Coal keeps the lights on. Clean, cheap coal. Horse feathers. We pay a power bill around here, and it's also almost exclusively coal-based. And the coal industry, the power, the electricity industry that buys all that coal has sought something on the order of a 75% rate increase in the past 4 years around here. How in God's name is that cheap? Answer, it's not. The immediate solution is to stop externalizing the cost of coal onto communities and to recognize that it carries tremendous costs with it and make the coal companies begin paying those costs. Cap and trade? Nuh-uh. Cap and tax. You know, Jesus, we tax liquor. We tax cigarettes. We tax food. I don't know if you saw the story or not, but a Republican from Nevada, recognizing that his state is going to have a god-awful shortfall of revenue, suggested, well, you know what we need to do? We're going to have to raise taxes. Really? A Republican saying raise taxes? Oh, really? There's only one problem. This is the minority leader of the Nevada House, Senate, not sure. His name is Pete, oh hell. Pete Goicochea? Pete Guacochea? G-O-I-O, no. G-O-I-C-O-E-C-H-E-A, and nobody gives pronouncers anymore. He's a Republican from Eureka. And he said the state's going to have some revenues increased. Now, there's a lot of fairly wealthy people in Nevada. A lot of poor folks, too. Most of them carrying the state on their backs already. So what did Pete, what the hell is his name, offer as a solution? Wow, of course. He wants to tax food. I believe that we should have a 2% sales tax on food on the ballot this fall. Really? Not a 2% tax on Maseratis? Mercedes? How about a progressive income tax increase that doesn't affect people making under, say, $100,000 a year? Jesus, God, what an antediluvian idiot. Since 2008, food stamp use in Nevada has nearly doubled. And that's not because Barack Obama is trying to get everybody dependent upon the state. That's because people don't have money with which to buy food anymore. But the fact of the matter is, the coal companies don't pay for the true cost of coal. And they should. They have, directly or indirectly, made these messes. We didn't tell you how to burn it. We just sold it to you. Well, Jesus, the heroin dealer doesn't tell you whether to smoke it or run it up your arm, but he's still moving the heroin now, isn't he? And it's same. Poison is poison is poison. A rose is a rose is a rose. So, that's one solution. Long-term, some of the long-term stuff is already underway. And that is to begin building a new smart power grid. Grid 2.0. And begin the actual doable research of learning how to store and transmit solar and wind-powered electricity all over the country, just like we do for coal-fired electricity. No, part of the solution is not to build more nuclear plants. Jesus. But that's okay. That's what the Tennessee Valley Authority is doing. They're going to idle a bunch of coal-fired plants over the next couple of years, and they're going to make up for the shortfall with clean nuclear power. Oddly enough, the spent fuel rods will not be stored out back of the administrator of the Tennessee Valley Authority's that house. It's not that clean. David in Tennessee noting something about the Gallatin steam plant. You might find this interesting because this is all part of that downstream effect. The cooling water that comes out of the Gallatin steam plant makes for fall-level water temperatures even in winter. Autumnal temperatures even in the dead of winter. Now, this is a visual thing, so just picture this in your mind, if you will. Boat after boat after boatload of working-class folks fill freezers with panfish to feed their families, knowing already that those crappies and catfish are tainted. Nice, huh? Because, see, the Cumberland River, like any other stream in the United States, has a mercury advisory already on it. You're not supposed to eat fish out of any stream in the United States more than once a month, or you're going to wind up like the Hatter at the Tea Party. Mad. And, see, that's just the mercury. That's not the arsenic. That's not the cadmium, the barium, the manganese, the magnesium, the selenium. That's none of that. It's just the mercury. Jiminy. You know, I know guys around here that go and put a trot line in the New River. I've had catfish out of the New River. God, it's so good. That sweet, non-fishy fish flesh with a... Oh, I've got a tartar sauce recipe. Oh! Pan-fried and cornmeal. Oh. It's toxic. It's all toxic. It's all... What's our word for tonight? The word from Unity is poison. Yeah. Let's see what's shaking. You know the phone lines are open, right? 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on. On your nickel, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Yes.
How you doing?
Hey, is this Tony?
This is Tony.
How you doing, bud?
I'm good. I just want to say before we get started, I don't know if I can speak for everybody on the horn, but we sure are glad that Agnes is okay.
Oh, I think you can, and so am I. And she'll be tickled to hear that.
Anyway, let's get down to business.
I was going to say, because you're the one who coined the phrase, "Oh, Bob, you married up."
That's right. You married up, buddy. She is a one hell of a lady. I only got to meet her for like maybe half a day, and I fell under her spell. Not a love spell, but you know what I mean. Anyway.
Oh, I do.
Nice person. Okay. First of all, when you talk about coal and nuclear power, I'm going to ask you this. With the Republicans all worried about like terrorist attacks and everything, it would be better if we went to solar power, because if they attacked the solar power station, what could possibly happen?
We have to replace the panels.
I mean, think about that. I mean, these guys are so concerned about terrorism that a nuclear power plant is a perfect target. How come they never make that connection?
Because there's an American Coal Ash Association, there's an American Nuclear Waste Association, an American Nuclear Power Association, and let's not give the terrorists any idea. You know, that almost sounds like an Onion story. Really stupid terrorists attack the sun.
But yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like, forget about all that crap, because all that terrorist alert stuff is mostly BS. But think about it. If we were really under attack as much as we say we were, it would be beneficial to us to go to alternative forms of fuel.
Sure it would.
You know what I'm saying? Because, I mean, like, once again, I don't believe half the stuff they tell us, but it would make us less targets. Like if you were a terrorist, you go, should we go after that solar plant or the nuclear plant? I mean, it's not hard to figure out which one they would go after.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And also, I'm going to skip around a little bit because I haven't been talking to you for a while.
Oh, that's okay.
Number two, the reason why that we have to raise taxes is the country's broke. I mean, they took us into wars. They've bled our economy. We're broke, Bob.
And yeah.
These Republicans go, oh, well, you can't raise taxes, but what are we supposed to do? I mean, really.
And then that Republican out there where you are, Tony, his answer is, hey, let's soak the poor folks.
Yeah, I mean, as you know right now, you know I'm on unemployment, but I think I have a job lined up, but it's still going to be a little while. But, unemployment doesn't pay that much, so I got to pay taxes now on the food? And I drive up and down the road. You know, I live in Vegas, and I'll be going around doing stuff, and I'll go by, like, little, you know, mid-sized car dealerships, and there's nobody on the lot. But we have specialized dealerships here, like sell Ferraris and stuff.
Yeah.
I'll go by there, and there's people on the lot.
Hell yeah.
And they're buying, you know, $200,000-$300,000 cars, and they don't want them taxed. But you get a guy who makes $30,000 a year, and he's buying a car, and they're going to soak him for everything.
Sure.
I mean, that makes no sense whatsoever, but...
Well, but see, the thing is that poor schmuck making $15,000 a year, he can't afford to buy a senator, Tony. Let alone, you know, granted, senators are cheaper than Ferraris, but he can't afford either one. And so since he can't afford one, he can't count on one to do the right thing by him.
Yeah, like, you know, you're talking about the politicians out here. Angle, that woman, Sharon Angle, the shimmer is starting to wear off, and people are starting to see what she's really like. Like, about, I think 3 months ago, she had like a 10-point lead on Reid, but that's wore off real quick. And I think Harry's got a pretty comfortable lead now. There's no...
Does he really?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's got a comfortable lead, because that woman, I mean, the shine fell off of that real quick. You know, a couple of interviews, and when she ran from the press, that was about pretty much it. Like you said before, she wanted to outlaw liquor. So, like, you know, we live in Vegas. I mean, come on. Yeah, you know, I mean, people heard that.
Maybe she can come out in favor of outlawing gambling while she's at it.
Exactly.
And scantily clad women. Oh, they'll just, they'll just run away from the polls for that.
People said, "You want to do what? Did I hear you okay?" I mean, that's not going to fly. I mean, come on. You know, this town was built on vices, and you want to outlaw one of them. But anyway, so I think that's pretty much, you know, that she's pretty much ran her course. And you heard about that stabbing of that guy. The Muslim cab driver?
Oh, yeah. All these things always happen when I'm not on the air.
What do you think about that?
You know, I tweeted, Tony, I tweeted that the people that have been aching for this, ginning up this phony controversy, have finally got what they wanted. They drew blood.
You know, you go on, I mean, I hate to go back to this, but we all use it as a reference point. You go on Fox, and it's 3 hours a night of Islamic bashing. You know, O'Reilly, Beck, Hannity, these guys will prod these people, and then when it happens, they don't, you know how Sean always puts his hands up in the air? They put their hands up there and go, well, we didn't tell them to go do this.
Oh, it's so funny because the anchor baby herself, Michelle Malkin.
Oh, Lord.
She had a hissy. Now she's got a disclaimer on her site that says, for anybody who comments on her show, or on her website, she's got a disclaimer that says, I do not own your comments, and I expressly disclaim any and all liability that may result from them. By commenting on my site, you agree that you retain all ownership rights in what you post here, and that you will relieve me from any and all liability that may result from those postings. Okay, so by definition, she disclaims any connection to any of the right-wing the hate freaks that frequent sites like hers. Now, what happened after the stabbing in New York? Well, or I guess it was more of a slashing, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was more of a slashing. It wasn't really a stabbing.
The guy meant to kill somebody. You know, when you're slashing with a knife at somebody's throat, you pretty much mean to kill. Well,
I'm sorry. You know, I used to drive cab, right?
Yeah, you told me.
Right, told you that. Okay, let me tell you something right now. I did it for 10 years. There is nothing scarier, and I will tell you this from experience, than picking up a crazy ride. And I'll tell you why. Number one, you're compromised because he's behind you. Right?
Right.
You can't really see him. So you basically, whatever he's going to do, you can't see until it's already done.
Right. You know, and it's not like that scene from the great animated classic Heavy Metal. Where you've got that foot switch and you flip up the gas pedal and step on it and you've got the disintegrator ray and his pistol falls into the front seat and you're done.
Oh, no, you're completely compromised because, you know, plus you're in a confined space. You know, there's really not a lot, and you can't really defend yourself because you have to control the vehicle. It's when you get a scary ride, like I'm sure if he's been driving cab for 15 years, which he says he was, I'm sure that his alarms went off when the guy got in because you sense when something's not right. You know what I'm saying? If you've been doing it for a while, then you know, like, oh, this is not going to turn out right. You know what I mean?
Yeah, oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Let me ask you a question, Tony. You said, you know, there's nothing scarier than getting a crazy ride.
Yeah.
Of the crazy rides out there, and, you know, we've got a fairly mixed culture now. It's not the land of the white and the home of the pink anymore.
Oh yeah.
But given the demographics of the country, who's more? I'm just curious if you can say it may be possible. It may be that you can't say, but if you're going to get a crazy ride, is that crazy ride going to be more likely white or somebody else?
I'm going to tell you the truth, and I know the truth is, and honestly, it's going to be a white person, and. I know people are going to go, well, what do you mean? But
well, no, I suspected as much.
It's 90. One time, here's a great story for you. Guy's at a strip club, picks up a ride. Okay, the dude he picked up doused him in lighter fluid and lit him on fire. The guy died. Okay, can you imagine that? Okay, and he was a white guy. One more story, and then we'll go on to another thing. Guy picked up three guys going from one hotel to another. They told him to go into the back. They beat him up. They're white guys. I know that it sounds like you're profiling, but the percentage is it's usually young white males. And people always say, well, don't pick up black people. But I gotta tell you the truth. In my 15 years of driving, I never had a problem with any black people. I know that sounds weird, but it's true.
No, it doesn't sound weird to me at all. I mean, crimes are committed by different people every day. But the fact of the matter is, dude with the knife in New York was an angry, right wing, pissed off white guy.
And most of them are right wings because when you work, work is work. You have to have pride in work. And anybody who goes to work every day, you know, no matter what kind of job it is, you do the best you can. But some people think because you're a cab driver that you're below them. And because most of them are like Middle Eastern and Korean and, you know, they come from Africa. So a lot of young white men, they sometimes get in the cab and they think, what are you doing in my country? But anyway, that is true. It's mostly young white. For lack of a better, and I know that I don't know their politics, but it wouldn't be hard to say they're Republicans. I mean, because they're just resentful that you're in their country anyway. But getting on to another story.
You know, what's so weird is that this guy is a volunteer with a nonprofit, Tony, the guy who did the New York job.
Yeah.
The guy he slashed, his name was Ahmed Sharif.
Yeah.
But the guy who did the slashing, allegedly, he's a volunteer with a nonprofit that works to promote cross-cultural understanding, and they're working on a film about Marines' experiences in Afghanistan, if you can imagine.
That's funny. That's funny. That's really funny. Let me tell you a story of what happened to me. You know my religion. We've talked about it. You've seen me. I wear my skull cap all the time, and I have a beard. You know that, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, but I was at a supermarket the other day, and I'm standing in line. It's the one right by my house, and all the checkers know me. And I'm standing in line waiting, and like, you wouldn't know I'm Hispanic because you wouldn't know. There's a lady standing in front of me, and I was a little bit close to her, but not too close. And she looked at me for a second, and then she looked back. She looked at me, and she goes, "Excuse me, could you step away, please?" And I went, "Yeah, why?" She goes, "Because you're making me nervous." And I went, "Really? What for?" Now, mind you, Bob, she doesn't know me, so I'm guessing she's going by the appearance. Right? Because, you know, I had my skull cap on and stuff. And I went, and then I said, okay. So I went and stood away, and she kept going on. And finally she said, because I know martial arts, and I'll do something to you. And I said to myself, well, first of all, you know me. I mean, I would never, I don't condone violence on women, right? I would never hit a woman.
I don't think you can, I don't think, if best I could tell getting to know you, you don't condone violence.
Yeah, so I said to her, I go, excuse me, ma'am. I go, I would never attack you. But you're in your mid-70s. If I wanted to do something, all I would do is tackle you. You know what I'm saying? And take you to the ground. No, I wouldn't. But, I mean, it was like she was profiling, dude. And I will bet you that she – I will bet you I can tell you what news channel she'll be watching.
No, that's a Fox viewer from the get-go.
Yeah, I was just standing there going, I don't believe this. But anyway, so you're going to that mountaintop –
Appalachia Rising.
My bad. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
Rising. And when is that again?
The 25th to the 27th of September in D.C.
Do you expect Miss Judd to show up or anything like that?
I think that's being worked on. We're hoping for thousands of people.
I was watching TV yesterday, and I saw an advertisement. She actually came out and did an advertisement for, like, I'm not sure what part of the country, but, like, to save wolves. It was a commercial for, like, telling people wolves aren't bad and we need to bring them back because they're almost...
Sarah Mussolini had a fit about that.
Oh, she did?
Oh, yeah.
Really? What did she say?
Oh, she got real catty and snarky about, how Hollywood, gotcha questions.
You know what's amazing to me about that?
What's that?
Miss Judd, I mean, she walks it like she talks it. I mean, she really... You know, because you can tell when, I think you can tell when people are only in it because they want the money or they want the fame, but she never like wears it on her sleeve. I mean, she just puts it out there and says, hey, this is what I'm for, and, come with me and we can do something good. I mean, she doesn't look for press. She does it on the sly. I mean, she doesn't go on The View and say, oh, I'm doing this or I'm doing that. Oh, she might to promote it, but, you know, she doesn't milk it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh, one more thing. Did you watch the Anthony Bourdain the two Lebanon specials?
Yes, I did.
Do you remember what I told you a while back about how when in Palestine when the Hamas won the election, how the Palestinians voted him in?
Right.
Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Now, when all this happened in Lebanon, who came in to help him? Hezbollah. Remember when Hezbollah, when the guy said, Hezbollah,
yeah.
if you need your house rebuilt, Hezbollah comes in with money. If you need security, Hezbollah comes in with money. When he was doing that show and he was on the street, Hezbollah showed up and said, what are you doing here? Right? Okay, are you filming? Okay, that's cool. Like I told you before, why do you think these people go with these people? Because they provide them security.
Sure, you know, and look, there are parallels in American society. Why do you think that so many people were absolutely enamored of what's his name? They called him the Teflon Don.
John Gotti.
John Gotti. There were people in Chicago who did not think Al Capone was a bad man because he provided within his community.
I mean, those people in Beirut, they just got bombed. I mean, so politicians aren't doing anything. Hezbollah comes in and says, here, man, we got you back. Here's money. Rebuild your house. And, like, they were sitting on the street filming, and these guys showed up out of nowhere and said, what are you guys doing here? And they made sure everything was okay, and they left. Now, if you're a guy who did, like I said before, if you don't have any protection, what are you going to do?
There you go.
You know what I mean? So, anyway, it's nice talking to you again, and I'm glad Agnes is okay. And I hope your kids are waiting on her hand and foot.
They are.
Oh, have you heard from Cassie?
No. I did hear that she, I guess next week she heads off to school.
You know, I got to tell you something. I look at kids like kids your age, and I see them on the street, I go, you guys are idiots, but wow, she's pretty amazing. I think anything's going to stop her.
We're all looking for, we're all looking for big things.
Yeah, she's good. Well, anyway, Bob, nice talking to you, and I hope to talk to you soon.
All right, take care, Tony.
Take care, bye.
Bye. I think I'm going to run a little audio for you. And this goes back a long way. This is 4 minutes and 23 seconds. This is a clip. And I'm reminded of this simply because of what Tony brought up. And this was a magic, magic moment in the early days of the Horn. This is our dear friend Dr. Bill O'Brien telling a little bit of his story, of his life. You know, Dr. Bill grew up in Boston. And it was at a time, I think this was probably back when Israel was doing something to torment poor people in Lebanon. This is one of the most profound moments that has ever happened on the Horn. And it's back when Dr. Bill was doing a daily show. Some of you listen to the PRISM series, PRISM, when we carried it live and streamed and podcasted and so forth. Back in early July from the campus of Concord University. Therein, you got a chance to hear Dr. Bill in his native element, i.e. the classroom. But to the same extent, Dr. Bill is equally comfortable behind a microphone. And this is a story Dr. Bill told about his own life, and he told it on the air, and this is exactly on point to what Tony was talking about. This is Dr. Bill O'Brien trying to explain what it means for organizations that are vilified, what they actually often mean inside the communities where they exist. This is Dr. Bill O'Brien.
I don't like to get too personal, but I can't help it. The example here is so obvious. If you bear with me for a moment, when I was younger, before I went to college, in fact, right at the time I began to go to college, I grew up in Boston. I grew up in a working-class family. My dad worked in a bakery, and he worked very hard, and he never really made a lot of money. He was a union member. I can remember my dad walking the streets for weeks for a 10-cent an hour raise when the company was only willing to offer a nickel. I mean, I can remember that. I grew up with it. When I graduated from high school and was going to college, something happened, and I broke my leg playing basketball in my first year in college. And my dad, as I mentioned, worked in a bakery. And Dad did other things besides work in a bakery. My dad was what we call, for lack of a better term, a bookie. He used to take numbers from people he worked with, and he would turn them over to what we call now organized crime. People that would take bets, off-track betting, and all of these other things, which are now illegal. It's been replaced by the lotteries. And I would suggest to you that government's entry into the business of lotteries is very, very similar to what I'm talking about. Because in Boston, and I know in other cities as well, there was a whole underground element of gambling going on. And poor people, my dad included, used to play numbers and bet horses off track and all of these other things. My dad was a bookmaker. He would collect the numbers, et cetera, et cetera. I knew it. I didn't know what it meant. It didn't bother me one way or the other. But in my freshman year in college, I broke my ankle. And that meant that the following summer, after my freshman year, I couldn't work. I was on crutches all summer. When it came time to go back to school for my sophomore year in the fall, I actually talked to my dad about dropping out for a year because I didn't have my tuition. I didn't have the money to go to school. And I fully intended to not return. One night, Dad came home from work, and he said, "You're not going to believe what happened." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, I was at work, and I was sharing the situation with people I know, one of whom was this guy, and I'll call his name for lack of a better term, Jack. Jack was the regional bookmaker. Jack was the guy that came around and picked up the numbers and the bets from my dad. And he said that he was telling Jack about the fact that I wasn't going to be able to go back to school because I hadn't been able to earn my tuition since I was on crutches all summer. And Jack handed my dad 10 $50 bills, $500, and said, "You go home and you make sure that Bill goes back to college." And my dad came home with $500 in his pocket. That's the most money he ever had one time in his life. And he talked about what a wonderful guy Jack was. And then he went into this philosophical argument about gambling. And he said, "I am so sick and tired of these people in the media telling us that organized crime supports drugs and prostitution, all these other things." He said, "This is the organized crime I know. Here's a guy that knew we were in trouble, and he gave no questions asked $500 to make sure that you could go to college." And his basic argument is, this is the only chance that poor people, working people have to make it big. His argument was that the little bit that we gamble, it's not coming off the table. And on the other hand, it gives us a chance at the American dream. It's the only chance that I'll ever have at the American dream, Dad said. And the proof of the pudding is in the fact that when we were in trouble, Jack delivered. I'm saying to you in today's program, Jack is my dad's equivalent of Hezbollah.
I get chills every time I hear that. Maybe, if we had a little bit better understanding of situations like that, we might have a little bit better understanding of the situation, whether it be in the occupied territories or in Lebanon itself. And I'm not kidding when I say that is one of the most profound moments that has ever, ever happened on the Horn. But it's exactly what Tony was talking about. 17 minutes past the hour. A couple of lines open if you want to jump in. 877-443-2366. 877, the numeral 4, head on. Otherwise, the direct dial, if you don't have to pay long distance or anything or don't need us to pay the freight with the 800 number, 304-658-3333. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Hey, it's Brian from New Hampshire.
Hey, Brian. How are you, buddy?
How are you? God, thanks so much for your good wishes and all the other Horn members there, the Horn family members about Casper. he's still with me. He's going to be with me in spirit for forever, for eternity and beyond, as far as I'm concerned, like his big Arctic Spitz brother there, Sasha, the 130-pound Samoyed, the big Russian farm boy there. He died in my arms February 95. But Casper, he's always going to be with me. He's going to be the second friendly ghost named Casper, I guess. I just miss him so much in physical form here. He's just a reassuring soulmate. The best soulmate I've ever had in my life has been Casper. They say the Arctic Spitz dog, the Samoyeds, and other dogs from the Arctic, like the American Eskimo dog, is like. I think a Casper was like an Arctic Terrier, kind of a feistier. Sasha was a big Russian farm boy. He could be more laid back, a Samoyed strong boy there. Casper was my soulmate, and he'll always be with me. He's like my Oedipus, you know, in the Greek tragedy in some ways. And he just brings me on to understand that, there's so much, you know, like in a little child and in a dog, that there's that unconditional love that human beings, as we grow into adulthood, as supposedly as we mature, we learn to hate. Our egos get in the way of things, whether it's male ego, female egos, whatever gets in the way of things, and especially male egos that's the cause of all wars and wars, tearing basically it to me. But the dog, the unconditional love, is like a newborn child there, straight from heaven. And I just want to thank so much everybody for their good wishes for me. We're hanging in there. Right now, as far as your, I was getting into to get onto something. To go on, go forward as best we can always. I'm so glad to hear my auntie and Casper's auntie Agnes is doing good. I'm so happy.
She is, as I've said, resting uncomfortably.
She had to go through a lot of preparation for the surgery too, or the.
Except for the part where you kind of starve yourself for a day and all of that stuff. No, not a whole lot. I mean, they got her in, they did the work, they kept her overnight and sent her home. But, you know, part of that's because the American healthcare system, you know, doesn't want you on the books any longer than it has to be. The other part is that, you know, I guess there's some science out there, Brian, that says that you heal better at home. Now, of course, you know, my task here, because I'm dealing with a wonderful but incredibly stubborn woman, is to try to keep her from coming home and washing the walls or scrubbing the floors or, I don't know, planing a door. Because given half a chance, that's what she'll do. I mean, we went through a gallbladder and stuff like that and, you know, brought her home and, you know, boom, up on her feet, go, 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 you know, sit down. And so I've learned after 17 years of marriage that it's okay for me to look at her and go, sit down. And she doesn't look at me too scathingly. She knows.
My mom, both my retired, my elderly parents, my beloved World War II father, and, you know, like I say, he was almost near as decorated as Audie Murphy, was at Monte Cassino there, that's like the Stalingrad of the Italian Peninsula of World War II. My Boston, just talk about Mr. O'Brien there, my Boston Irish street kid father there, World War II veteran and all that. If he dared say that to my half-Irish mother there, he'd end up halfway across the kitchen.
Well, there you go. Like I said, it's only after 17 years of marriage that I dare to say something like that.
Every family has their own way of handling these things. But the fact is also, I was going to you're having that mountaintop anti-mountaintop removal gathering September 25th to 27th.
Yes, in D.C.
Yeah, that's what I don't think I'm hoping to get myself into better shape where I'm going to be campaigning for both Paul Hodes and Carol Shea Porter there for Congress up here. She's one of the people there where I think she's one of the good progressive. Even if you were very strict, you had to be 100% pure progressive, which you can't be with any candidate. I don't think in today's political system there, the media has so skewed things, and we're 300 million people in this nation. We're a complicated nation, especially in national politics. You can't look for such 100% purity or even close to that if you really want it. Just look for an honest, some really you can see honestly cares about the people there. But Carol Shea Porter, representative here in New Hampshire's 1st District, is that kind of person there. I'm going to support her, continue supporting her. and he's like, she's one of the, it's, and she's of the 100, she was one of the 102 Democrats that voted against the recent Afghan funding increase, $37 billion funding increase for the Afghan war. And we can't let the, there's more, and there's other ones too that are leaning, the 102 Democrats there and people like that, we can't just desert them in November 2010. I've done, after losing, like I say, my soulmate there, Casper, I've done some soul searching there. I've looked up into this thing called there is a Christian Socialist Party in America, apparently, and I've gone over, and the Christian Socialism, of course, they're much stronger in nations like Germany and in Europe. But it seems to fit right in with, I believe strongly in, the Prince of Peace, that he was at the very least an incredibly amazing man, that the real Jesus of history. I'm going by the Gnostic Bible and some of the Gospels of the real thinking Jesus, the real teacher named Jesus, the 12-year-old young Jewish lad there, a rabbinical student there, basically was teaching the elders of the local. Talmudic.
The temple. Yeah, I mean, they say that he was in the temple in Jerusalem. You know, mom and dad wandered off, and they went, "Hey, where's Junior?" And he was back at the temple, teaching the old guys.
And the money changers that he threw out of the temple were basically be the neocons and libertarians or Republicans and phony Democrats, DLC, Blue Dog Democrats, corporate.
Blanche Lincoln would get tossed. Yeah. So would Ben Nelson. Yeah. So would my Democrat in name only governor, you know, Joe Manchin. That's your guys.
And I did whatever few shekels I could afford to Mr. Heckler there, and I just told, you know, the protest. I know it's hard to get the mansion has everybody behind him, but I turned off a couple of Facebook friends there because that I could see in their web pages they support Republican candidates, and for me, after Ronald Reagan and to the recent future there, and Alan Greenspan, the phony libertarian, the biggest tax increase in history, Social Security payroll tax, and those Social Security surpluses more than $4 trillion, George W. Bush was allowed to steal them. That's called embezzlement. Any local government representative does that. He was legally allowed to do that, but I don't think I think they violated the law. Great, in the whatever Congress, Republican, Democratic Congress that went along with that also did so. That was the American workers. They paid into it. Social Security is a very effective program. It's a great thing to save the middle class in this country, like Medicare and Medicaid. Not one Republican voted for either Medicare or Medicaid. Mr. Johnson proposed them in the mid-1960s, and when FDR instituted Social Security in 1935, not one Republican voted for that, and they are still the same, the libertarians and others, the social Darwinists and these phony Tea Partiers. They should realize, just talk about Mr. O'Brien there from Boston, the Boston lad there. The original Boston Tea Partiers, people need to remember, they were anti-corporatists to the very core in the 1772-1773 period. They were the tea into the harbor there, as were most of the founding fathers there. They didn't want, I don't think they really wanted to begin to consider, I guess it was more into the mid-19th century where the corporation charters were begun to, be allowed again. Or, you know, like the British East India Tea Company, there were many other corporations that profited from the colonial people that we then were prior to 1783 of America. But these phony Tea Partiers today, these people, they are, if you want to stop the coal ash, the disgusting and things like that, Bob, we let these people get in again, Don Blankenship has a free ride. I mean, bad as Barack Obama is with this clean coal nonsense, as bad as he is, he still tried to institute some reforms, and he would never. 8 years of Al Gore would never have allowed what Dick Cheney allowed with his secret energy.
Oh no, never in a million years. Yeah. Not even with Joe Lieberman as vice president.
Would never have allowed the Deepwater Horizon, this volcano, to occur under those libertarian free market and government hands off that allowed them to drill like that without the shutoff valve, without their relief wells that are required by law in every other oil producing country, major producing country on the planet. on Mother Earth. But talking about that, protecting Mother Earth there, I've gone over, like I said, we did get rid of one of the coal fire burning plants up here in New Hampshire. There's still one left that they seem to be phasing it out. And I'm going by a story I read here. This was in the July 8th to 14th. It's a local progressive-leaning paper there out of Manchester, New Hampshire, the Hippo. It's at hippopress.com, like the hippopotamus. And that ties in with something I may want to get into if we have time about sea mammals. Hippopotamuses and the animals like that are the ancestors of whales, I believe, of the primordial times, the amphibians that they came.
Yeah, it's my understanding that the whale actually evolved from a wolf-like creature.
Yeah, they say that could be the mesiodactyl or mesiodactyl, but I believe it's now they found out that it's artiodactyls, which include boats and deer and cows and other rhinoceroses, that they seem to be far more the ancestors from the latest DNA testing up until like the 70s and 80s and late 1980s or so. Everybody was thinking, yeah, it was some kind of very ancient large wolf there that had to become amphibious and over the eons, and that's what. As a Christian socialist, I believe I believe in evolution strongly. And I still believe that the great creator, that this, whether call it the Big Bang, call him or her God, Buddha, Yahweh, Allah, whatever names that great Native American civilizations call the creator, it fits right in with the God, something that would create something so beautiful as the life on this planet. I just finished to try to get the cast for that. I had an old videotape there, VHS tape, 1982, Jacques Cousteau, story about sea mammals there, about whales, and I got the title of it right here. Just a minute. Yeah, Cousteau Odyssey number 10, Video Treasures, The Warm-Blooded Sea, Mammals of the Deep. And it's just beautiful story. These whales and dolphins there, it's still, I believe it. I don't care about this cleaned up, toxic, or the thing that tried to make the oily water clear there in the Gulf. We assassinated the Gulf of Mexico with what's happened there. God love those poor fishermen there, the people you're just talking about with the panfish that they need to live. This is evil, but the e-mammals, the dolphins, their brains are so highly developed that they have one dolphin there named Dolly, she was a former Navy recruit dolphin there who was, supposed to be used to detect any frogmen, but she was just such a pod leader there, like the leader of the pack would be for wolves or that kind of, such an alpha female in this case. But she was just, but so incredibly intelligent. She finally, they let her go free there, the Navy, because she made a home with this lady there. She's from Florida there that area there, the Keys and maybe the same sets nearby where Flipper was filmed or whatever. But she's a nice blonde lady, the real color, gentle Southern belle, but especially with this dolphin. Her little 12-year-old girl there was riding with this Dolly. They did the same tricks with her. Dolly can go and leave whenever she wants. This was in the 80s there. She could go, but she never wanted to go past the, there's like a buoy that marks the end of the canal there where it goes more into the open ocean. She never went beyond there. I'm guessing for the rest of her life, because she knew going back out to there was where the Navy captured her and used her, they enslaved her.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to put it. But the fact that these sea mammals, our other creatures on this planet, either we become more attuned to see God, not as like our founding fathers are our founding patriots, like I just say in the Boston Tea Party, there were many brave women there that were just barely in the background, and in the Civil War there, the Ken Burns, great New Hampshire filmmaker there, the Civil Burns, the Civil War documentary, so many great women's roles were, more and more, where the rights were coming further and further. It's disgusting still to think that they didn't get the right to vote until 1920. You think of the great women, and that's the soul of this planet. It's Mother Earth, and if we're going to be true to the Creator, we have to understand the life around us, whether it's plants or animals. But in this Hippo Press piece, there is talking about they're replacing one of the coal fire plants, the New Hampshire Public Services, with they use wood chips, and it has the big chainsaw. My neighbor has the Brandon there, the Husqvarna, the real good quality chainsaw. How this, the big picture of the chainsaw, can save our forest of New Hampshire. And it shows the story of trees and logging in New Hampshire. And it shows, it's interesting that, these loggers, they know what they're doing. They understand a lot about conservation, too, that not every tree cutting company or logging company just wants to cut everything bare. They're not like George Bush, George W. Bush. Well, you get rid of the trees, you get rid of the forest, you get no more forest fires,
Yeah, the Healthy Forest Initiative. I remember it well.
Yeah. They're not that at all, but they talk about, to quote one of the loggers there, if you whack down one acre, the very next year it's all brush, and that's exactly what moose are looking for, whereas in deep old forest they don't have much to eat. And so it goes on from there, and it talks about this wood chips that they make, there's still some pollution, but it's much cleaner, like you were saying, alluding to a phone call I had before with you, Bob, it's much cleaner than coal. And there's so many other, and you mentioned the, of course, nuclear. I got my questions about that. Obviously, with the nuclear waste, it hasn't been very well regulated. Now, it's not just been since the 1950s. There hasn't been much reform in the handling of. There's some place out in Colorado, Rocky Flats or something like that. Some place. It's just like that's a kind of a radioactive dead zone. We didn't have a Chernobyl there, but it just over the years of the just unregulated use of this highly deadly and endlessly toxic and deadly material that the radioactive waste is, we've had this result. But there's solar, there's electricity, electric cars, there's wind, and there's also geothermal energy. Is something that New Hampshire, it may be in the mountains here. I know you talked to a caller there. That was a few weeks back, and I had to go. I went about a half a month without the internet or the phone. There's a problem there, damn thing there. But it talked about how they were hiking the Appalachian. The guy from Maine, but he was the Appalachian Mountains. They begin there in New England.
Yes, absolutely.
The Appalachian Trail. Yeah, it begins up here. Or it goes all the way down south there, but it's not just out in Wyoming and out in the great northern plain states there, Montana, Wyoming. There's geothermal places here that are, and it's so much cleaner that than coal, as long as it's not unregulated, where they have to also they try to Dick Cheney and these people with their energy deregulation. They want it also where they can farm the coal, the gas, out of the same thing, and the geothermal, without properly, no the proper safety, instruments and equipment put in place there. At the same time, it has any kind of energy has to be regulated, but except for say, like your previous caller there say, like a solar power plant. Yeah, Al Qaeda could probably bomb that, and it might be a lot of money to replace the solar panels, but it's nothing like a nuclear plant.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But I wanted to go ahead with that. There's a positive things there. I just wanted to say that people are, thanks so much again for your good words for Casper there. He's, like I say, that my dogs have been the closest thing to a child that I'm able to care of as a mentally ill guy there. Believe me. Or they take care of me is to really put it accurately.
Well, what did Mark Twain say, Brian? Said, if heaven were attained on merit instead of faith, our dogs would get in and we'd stay outside.
Yeah, that's right. We wouldn't have a chance against the canine species there. That's right. Okay, and I love you guys so much, and God bless. I'll keep some more prayers in there for Agnes' continued recovery there, and God bless everybody there in the Horn family. Have a good night, sir.
Thank you, Brian. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye now. What a guy Brian is. It's almost impossible to catalog one of his calls. There's so much good information in there. And so many things to form the basis of further conversation. It's what makes him the gem that he is. Let's keep things rolling along. We're about a little over halfway through the program this evening and see what's happening. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Jim, what's up?
Well, first, I'm so happy that your wife has undergone that procedure and she is resting, maybe uncomfortably, but like I said before in my email to you, thankfully, pain is something that is often somewhat forgotten. You know what I'm saying?
Indeed, it's one of the it's one of those little defense mechanisms that human beings have evolved over the millions of years, and it's a it's a biological blessing. You know, I say she's resting uncomfortably because I just don't think that after being cut open, there's any way to rest comfortably.
Well, one thing about it, it is behind her.
It is indeed, and she says she already feels dramatically better.
I'm sure she does. Peace of mind is something that. If something is, you can't buy that.
No, not with any amount of money. But she's got, you know, she's got some good industrial strength pain medication, and I'm seeing to it that she takes it because, you know, the one key with all of that, Jim, and it's a phrase I learned a while back, you want to stay ahead of the pain.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Been there. Going to Brian, my heart goes out to him. I have been there. I have done that. Losing the best friend you've ever had is one thing. Dealing with the aftermath of it is so very, very hard. It really is. I mean, when you look at where the... Well, when you look at what used to be and you compare it to what is now, that separation is indeed very difficult. And my heart goes out to it.
Thank you, Jim.
And...
As usual, that is very, very well said.
Can we go over a little bit of history here?
Sure.
Well, going back to our late departed Alphonse Capone.
Yes.
You know, so much has, I remember watching this program called The Untouchables and how Elliot Ness and his G-Men did all this stuff out.
Oh, narrated by who?
You got Robert Stack or somebody like that.
Well, no, the voiceover narration was by God. Why can't I remember? He was a noted radio commentator. You know the name.
Walter Winchell.
There you go.
Oh God, that asshole. Excuse me.
Well, sometimes only certain words will do, Jim.
Mm. Well, you know, Big Al what said. You know, if he had not gone into the world of crime, he would have made a wonderful CEO or a marvelous businessman. I mean, even
oh yeah, he could have had an MBA from the University of Chicago without a doubt.
But Al got his MBA on the streets of Brooklyn and Chicago itself. And one thing he did say, and I'm not defending him, and I'm not defending his practices because they were indeed quite horrible. But he said of liquor, he said, you know, I am prosecuted because I provide this stuff, but yet when they serve it over on Lakeshore Drive, they call it hospitality.
And it's the truth.
It is the truth.
And again, you know, it's one of those things I don't understand why we never learned, or so many of us, or so many people in government never learned. You know, the thing that gave rise to Alphonse Capone was not booze. It was the prohibition on booze.
Exactly. I mean, you know, that gave the mafia and the underworld its basis to really become solidified. And after prohibition was repealed, they simply went into other rackets. I mean, even, you know, with the certain members of the mafia, some of the old godfathers would not get into drugs and stuff like that, because of the penalties attached and what would happen to the people if they were caught and how it would destroy the organization. But, of course, you had other younger members who wanted to see it as a money-making thing. They didn't care whose souls they destroyed with narcotics and things of that nature. And I think it was kind of presented very well in one of the Godfather movies. I think Godfather 1. And it's an interesting thing.
Well, you know, it's so funny that J. Edgar Hoover himself had to be dragged kicking and screaming to the admission that there was a mafia in the United States.
Well, I think we all know the reason for that.
It was after the breakup of the Appalachian meeting at the home of Joe the Barber, Barbara, Appalachian, New York.
I don't remember which one called it. It was just stupid as hell. But that's when they all got together and rented out these motels, and all these big cars came in, and all these guys in sharp skin suits were attending this meeting, and you know they broke it up, and all of a sudden these mafia dons were running pell mell, helter skelter.
Yeah, they said they found $100 bills in the woods for years thereafter.
Yeah, they did. Sure did. I mean, you know, that was something else. And but anyway, the history of organized crime in this country was basically very much accelerated by prohibition and the evils that it caused. I mean, it was a godsend to them. And there's another thing I want to share with you, if I may, and that's about our founding fathers, okay? And the reason for the separation for the mother country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these taxes that they were raising hell about had been on the books since 1733. The Molasses Act, the Hatt Act, the Iron Act, the Wool Act. And the British Parliament basically did not enforce the collection of those taxes. But it was after the French and Indian War, when they realized they needed the money, they said, well, you know, we sent soldiers over there, and we protected you from the French and the Indians.
Right.
And now we want you to help, you know, pay for some of the cost.
Carry the burden.
And after the American Revolution, 20% of the population of this country left.
Yeah, they either went back to the mother country or went up to Canada.
Exactly. And, you know, part of my family were Tories. And part of them were, loyalists.
Well, there were a lot of, you know, I talked, I guess it was either earlier this week or sometime last week, about the Battle of Kings Mountain. And that was, you know, that was a British army, titularly, Colonel Ferguson headed it, but it was made up of colonial loyalists to the crown.
Exactly. And, you know, there's an interesting book called, by Charles Woodmason, A History of the Carolina Backcountry on the Eve of the Revolution. It is a very interesting read. And he was an Anglican parson who was sent to Charleston, South Carolina. And as he wrote, well, a horse kicked him in the scrotum. And he said, thus rendering me unfit for nuptial rites. But he went on to write about the history of what was going on in the backcountry of the of South Carolina. And he held this meeting to try to convert people back to the Anglican Church, the true faith that he believed in. And the Presbyterians and the Baptists turned loose a whole bunch of dogs on this meeting and broke it up. And one of the dogs followed him home. And somebody asked him, where'd you get the dog? He said, well, I tried to hold a type of church meeting, and I could at least convert somebody. But The History of the Carolina Backcountry on the Eve of the Revolution by Charles Woodmason is an interesting read. It certainly is. But, you know, going back to this energy thing, I don't know what to say about it because, number one, you've got everybody in their pockets. By you, I mean the coal people, the oil people. They've got the PSC in their pockets. Any tax they would levy on them, of course, the PSC is going to give them permission to levy a higher tax on us.
Pay it, sure. Pass it on.
They're going to pass it on. And we have really not had a very responsible energy policy in the history of this country. I mean, I have been dealing with, for example, anti-nuclear power plants since the 1970s, when I told you about the no nukes incident.
Right.
That. And, of course, the reason they want to have these centralized facilities is they can, of course, regulate it charge for it, and, of course, it produces a lot of tax revenue, things of that nature, not nearly as much as...
And in many instances, it's the construction is government-subsidized.
It is, indeed.
I mean, witness the... How many billion dollars did President Obama say we were sending down to Georgia to build some new nuke plants down there?
I don't remember. I didn't catch that one.
I think it was eight.
Mm-hmm. Trouble is, Bob, when a nuclear power plant, when they started building those things, they were only built to be in service for 25 years. Because, you know, eventually, the materials that of which they're constructed, it doesn't last forever. We're not talking about Cheops Pyramid.
No.
We're talking about concrete and stuff like that that degrades, and, of course, you've got to deal with all this fissile material that these plants produce. But they went ahead and did it. And, you know, I'm not so much afraid of one of those places being attacked by terrorists as I am, for example, a seismic event under one.
Or one of those places being attacked by rank incompetence. See, Jim, I think I've told the story before, but I grew up about 18 miles from what was at one point in time the largest reactor in the world at Browns Ferry in northwest Alabama. And there was an incident long before Three Mile Island ever happened, long before Chernobyl, and there was a fire that came within minutes of turning the entire region into toast. And that fire started when some maintenance guys were going through there. Of course, they worked for TVA. Some maintenance guys were going through and checking for gas leaks with a candle. And they found one.
I bet they did.
I mean, they found it with a side of fries.
My God in heaven. Well, you know that incident at Chernobyl. If you look into that, they were operating that plant and scrammed that reactor against any regulations that existed at that time in the Soviet Union, which were much, much freer or less enforced than they are over here.
Right, the kind of regulations that American business would love to have now. Non-existent, just like the coal ash. I mean, I didn't know that when I was reading that off that report. I had no idea that there are so many states that don't even remotely regulate that kind of intensely concentrated poison. But it's the truth.
But there are ways that they can diminish the effects of coal burning and things of that nature to make it at least a little safer until a transition can be made. But, of course, people are always reactive and never proactive. You know that, I know that.
Absolutely. And the case, you know, the reason we've got all this coal ash now is, or have it in more copious quantities, is as a direct and proximate result, Jim, of our attempts to curb acid rain. Acid rain was very real and very much a threat. And it was especially a threat to people downwind of these hateful places. And so, consequently, we, under the aegis of the Clean Air Act, and I mean, it's just true. It's a bummer, but it's true. We said, you know, we're going to stop putting so much of this particulate matter into the air. And that meant that scrubbers were installed. And the scrubbers yield the coal ash waste, which then something has to be done with. And the solution was to just put it in a pile somewhere and wet it down so it won't blow away.
Well, you know, I would hope that they would find some way to take that material from those and contain it, and as they would fissile material. Wouldn't you think that would be some type of partial solution to an immediate problem?
I think it would, but the question is, just as is the case with so-called carbon capture and storage, it's sort of like the opposite of opening a genie's lamp or a genie's bottle. It's more like what happens when you cram the genie in the bottle and the genie finally gets loose, because the genie will. You know, with carbon capture and storage, Jim, they want to figure out a way to capture all of the CO2 coming off of these plants and pump it underground. And, you know, you mentioned seismic instability. Well, that's going to have an impact.
You know, from what I understand, and I was just watching something last night on the Ring of Fire in the along the Pacific Rim. You know, apparently, we've got a lot of underground seismic activities due to water getting into the magma and stuff like that, that is beginning to create more and more volcanoes, earthquakes, and things of that nature. I mean, places like in the Mariana Trench, places like that. And there's not a whole lot we can do about that. Geothermal energy is a wonderful thing. And it's used in France and other countries, but France has been a leader in that. But, I mean, that is something that's real hard to control, particularly when you have the west coast of this country that is shifting toward the west 4 inches every year. Last time I was in California, I stood right in the middle of the San Andreas Fault. And I thought to myself, good Lord, not if, but when.
There you go.
I mean, it's just like a huge, it looks like a ditch.
And something like that, that's a natural process, and you say not if, but when. Well, what can a human being say except the very same thing about a man-made edifice like the Brushy Fork impoundment down in Raleigh County? You know, this is something that's made out of dirt and rock, literally. That's it. And it's holding back 9.8 billion gallons of toxic waste. I mean, life-ending toxic waste. And the engineering reports from Massey are abundantly clear. It's Massey's own engineering reports. And they say that when the dam breaks, 1,000 people die immediately. And a 40 to 60 foot wall of this toxic waste travels the entire length of the Coal River, all the way down to where it empties into the Kanawha at St. Albans.
And the reaction to that report was, just let it stay there?
It was cleared. It was certainly cleared to be built because it sits there to this day, the largest dam in the Western Hemisphere.
Well,
and one of own, and you know, not an isolated thing. That area is dotted with those damn things. With no plans whatsoever for how to deal, and you know, bear in mind that the sludge that's underneath, that's behind them, Jim, is sitting on old mined out works that are already full of water in the first place. There's tremendous hydrologic pressure on the insides of the mountain. Bear in mind that they have no plans for doing anything with it except letting it sit there. And one of these days, and it's not even one of these days, these things break. Yeah, the what was it, 2000 in Martin County, Kentucky? A dam gave way, and the insides of the mountains blew out at the same time. Luckily, nobody died. But a massive area of eastern Kentucky was rendered toxic, and is still. Just like East Tennessee, where the Kingston coal ash dam broke. You know, we don't talk about it anymore. It was barely talked about when it happened. But the fact of the matter remains that that area remains toxic and is going to be for the foreseeable future. The fact that we don't talk about it doesn't negate the toxicity.
But, you know, unfortunately, they probably will not do anything about it, being absolutely realistic.
I mean, I remember when the Kingston thing happened, and the first thing TVA did was to run out, and it was a little bit like September 11th, 2001, when the government came out and said, oh, the air is safe to breathe. Breathe all the air you want. Well, the TVA did the same thing in East Tennessee. First thing they said, drink the water. Water's fine. Great water. 2 days later, they kind of had to eat crow because all the water was poison.
Well, those agencies of the federal government that are designed to try to do the right thing have been so emasculated, and people have been placed in those agencies as political appointees that will prevent them from doing the right thing. You know, you've got like foxes tending the hen house, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, like I said, you know, I can't afford a senator. Neither can you.
I know. By the way, you'll be happy to know today I received my absentee ballot, and it's in the mail, and I voted for Ken Heckler.
Bless your heart. And you know what? The one nice thing about voting absentee, Jim, is the fact that you know that at some point they're going to have to count your vote.
Exactly.
If you had gone and voted on one of those video game touchscreen machines, there's no way of knowing it.
Absolutely correct. But
and you know what? He may surprise people because, among other things, there has been a groundswell of support. He has gotten some money in, and he's made a few ad buys.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. But at least, you know, that's a voice crying in the wilderness. Let's hope it'll be heard. And I don't know. I just wish that people would realize what we're doing to ourselves and try to come up with some solutions. I mean, look at the petroleum industry. It is finite, that's for sure. But look what has come out of the petroleum industry. The petrochemical industry. I mean, look around your studio. How much of the equipment is...
Oh, everything that's made of plastic. And there's a lot of plastic in here.
That's what I'm saying. And they have a stranglehold on this country and other countries that I just don't see how it can be broken, at least not in the immediate future. I mean, they're going to have to re-engineer the whole manufacture of plastic and things of that nature and other materials that are of the petrochemical industry that are here today. They're going to have to completely re-engineer all that stuff. And that's not going to happen overnight. And that's just, you know, that's just...
No, you're right now, you are making the absolute best argument for getting started. Because it's not going to happen overnight. It has to happen. It has to be, by definition, slow or gradual in nature.
You know, I have been doing that for the past 30 years as far as, you know, taking a far-reaching look at beyond the immediate and what is going to happen. And I haven't done a whole lot, but I've certainly done a lot of thinking about it, and I think more and more people are becoming more and more aware of the fact that one day these finite resources are going to be exhausted, and then what? But here again, people always have to be reactive and not proactive. I mean, solar energy, for example, that's a wonderful thing, but it is prohibitively expensive the way it is now, and they want it to be.
And that is, but again, that is in large part because the true cost of coal is not born in the natural economic cycle. And the fact of the matter is, it is every day solar gets a little less expensive. The biggest problem facing solar right now is not a collection issue, but rather a storage and transmission issue. Because even the grid that we have that with coal-fired energy being transported across power lines hither, thither, and yon, there's tremendous waste in that.
Oh, you mean our power grids?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good Lord. And they're very fragile.
And one of the nice things out there that's one of the less appreciated aspects of the stimulus program is that there is millions of dollars, billions, in fact, going into clean energy. Not the least of which is, in fact, a new grid, Grid 2.0, the smart grid. And, you know, you, Jim, have an appreciation greater than mine because you were older than me and therefore were aware of it. You know the sense of can-do that attended the United States of America when we decided to go to the moon.
Yes, I do.
And when we decided that we were not going to let the world get roasted in a nuclear war.
Yes, I do.
And all the other things that we decided we were going to do. You have an appreciation of that. Well, we've just had 30 years from Ronald Reagan until 2009, roughly, of Republicans telling America that we can't do anything anymore and to be proud of it. And the fact of the matter is, we are smart enough to build a smart grid. We are sharp enough to do the things that we need to do. And the only thing standing in our way are those self-same Republicans out there screaming, no, we can't, God bless America. And their corporate owners, who for some reason or another have a vested interest, you know, like the coal companies and the oil companies, in not profiting by the future itself. You know, so much of corporate America, so much of business in America, Jim, has always, up until recently, been predicated on the notion that the future is where the money gets made.
Well, you're right there. And, you know, the wealthy people, and they don't care. And, you know, Juanita brought out something the other night, God bless her, in which she was talking about how these people don't care anything about poor people and whether they die or whether they have a means to exist. And she said it was almost like they want us to go away. And I was just thinking, you know, I think it was Shakespeare and Julius Caesar who said, when beggars die, no comets are seen, but when princes die, the very heavens blaze forth. And I think that's their kind of attitude about, you know, it's so cavalier.
It is, Jim, and it's very true. And that's why the economic model that prevails in America today is predicated on not having to have any American working class. You know, whether it's the offshoring or the whole, you know, I think I've said it before, the furnace that my father labored on in Northwest Alabama was packed up literally, and they, you know, they numbered each piece and shipped the whole damn thing to China.
Yeah, I remember you telling me.
Because American and transnational businesses can make a fortune off of that that low-paid, low-wage labor, and continue to get rich. And suddenly they've got this notion that they don't need the American middle class to prop up the economy anymore. So they really don't care what happens to us. And to say that, and where the lower classes are concerned, it's not even that they don't care. The lower classes are beneath notice to American transnational corporations.
That's true. You know, even in China, for example, when I watched documentaries about how they prepared for the Olympics when they had them in Beijing, and how the bird's nest was built, the stadium, it was just incredible the amount of prodigy and technology that went into that. But on one hand, they are so wise and capable. And on the other, they're being very foolish with some things. They really are. Now, I'm not sure.
And yet it's the Chinese who are going hand over fist to bring online more and more and more renewables. And they're also manufacturing the infrastructure for the creation of them.
You mean with the Three Rivers Dam?
Oh, no, not just that. I mean, they're bringing on wind. They're putting up wind turbines as fast as they can get them built. They're putting up solar as fast as they can get that built.
Well, here again, I hear if our neglect of our entire infrastructure, and certainly our power grid, is an integral part of that infrastructure because it keeps it going. And, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot to shut down a power grid in this country. I've seen what happens when a storm comes up and you have...
Oh, we get clouds in the sky over here and the power goes out.
I mean, you know, really, you have... I can remember when the half eastern seaboard went out because of a very minor thing that could have been, you know, proactively corrected.
Sure, and winter's coming again. How long before the first great winter storm, and how many minutes on the heels of the announcement of the arrival of that great winter storm, Jim, will come the words, and 100,000 people are without power? There were people in West Virginia last winter, Jim, who were out of power for 2 and 3 and 4 weeks.
I remember. God, yes, I certainly do.
And you know what? The pro-coal people, the friends of coal and so forth, they like to say, and I heard it on a Beckley radio station the other day and I about puked, you know, well, those tree huggers can just go freeze in the dark. Well, you know what? Those weren't tree huggers who lost power in the big winter storms last year. Those were dedicated friends of coal, some of them. But you know what? It didn't make the lights come on any faster.
No.
Because part of the problem we have in this country, going back to the origins of some of this conversation, lie in the fact that a public service commission is supposed to regulate public utilities. But the point, of, but in point of fact, American Electric Power, which owns Appalachian Power, which is my electricity provider, they take all of the money they get and they plow it into quarterly profits. And they plow as little as possible into actual infrastructure. And then when they get caught out by a storm and a bunch of lines go down, they go howling to the PSC saying, we got to have more money. When in fact they've had enough money all along had they not been paying it out in profits.
Well, here's the thing, Bob. The Public Service Commission doesn't regulate them. They regulate the Public Service Commission.
Well, that's the exact truth.
And they let them get away with murder. And they let them do this stuff. And they have so many of these people in their pockets, as I said at the onset of this conversation, it is incredible. Just absolutely incredible. But we've gone the whole gamut here, and I appreciate the time. And I just wanted to share a few of those things with you. They didn't mean a whole lot. But anyway, I'm glad that you're on the downside of your own problem with Agnes. Let's just hope some people will begin to try to be a little more appreciative of the futures of their children. And that's what we're talking about.
I think it absolutely is, Jim, and maybe that's the reality. Maybe we need to, they say you can't live in the future, but by God, you can certainly live cognizant of it.
You can, but the trouble is, what I'm afraid of is, they're passing their own ideals on to their children.
Who will happily fiddle while Rome burns. Now, look, yeah, absolutely, and I am going to roll on, but, consider for a moment those recent hateful, miserable, spite-filled words of Alan Simpson, that old toad from Wyoming, who declared that Social Security is now a cow with 310 million tits.
Is that what he said?
Yes, sir.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. That doesn't surprise me.
He said it in an email, and it was released, and he said, we've reached a point now where it's like a milk cow with 310 million tits.
Yeah, well, I'll think about in 2000, the difference between the lockbox that Al Gore talks about and the position in which we find ourselves today. I mean, these people, in my opinion, who allowed this to happen are much more culpable, much guiltier than any godfather that they can put up on the screen.
Or any terrorist.
Yeah. Because that's what they have practiced, is economic terrorism in this country.
Right. See, a 6-foot-7-inch Arab on a portable dialysis machine living in a cave in Pakistan, well, he didn't poison every stream in the United States. Corporate transnationals did that, Jim.
And, of course, they're transferring any attention from what is a real problem to people like him. I mean, he's the best friend they ever had.
Sure he is. And again, George W. Bush was the best friend he ever had. He spent 8 long years trying to bait Bill Clinton into a war that it only took once to get George Bush dead or alive. Now we find ourselves bereft of how much blood and treasure, in excess of 5,000 lives lost, 1 million Iraqis dead. We've marched our last so-called combat brigade out of Iraq, and the State Department has replaced them with mercenaries. Bombs are going off all over Iraq. And we got what out of it? I saw a post the other day where T. Boone Pickens was complaining that he couldn't get George Bush to nationalize Iraq's oil for our benefit. In other words, steal Iraq's oil. And he said that he tried to convince Barack Obama to do it, too. And see, that's the thing. If you've got enough money, it doesn't matter if you're crazier than a sprayed roach. You can get a meeting with George W. Bush, or you can get a meeting with Barack Obama. And you know what? What we need to do is we need to steal that their oil. That's what we need to do. They got 310 million barrels of oil, and we got 5,000 dead and got nothing for it. By God, we need to steal it.
Well, that was one of the reasons Saddam invaded Kuwait. It's because
Kuwait was stealing his oil.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm no friend of Saddam, and I don't exactly support his practices and those of the Mukhabarat, his secret police. But when we went in there, we destabilized an entire part of the world.
And to his credit, George H.W. Bush knew better than to do that because he knew that's what would happen.
Thank you, sir. You have a good evening.
You take care, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. You ever wonder why I love doing this show? Things like conversations like this are why I love doing this show. The conversations that happen here are why I love doing this show. And I think, frankly, that you get something out of it as well, along the same lines as I do. You know, I had an email a couple of nights ago, and I didn't get to respond to it in writing, and for that, I blame myself, and I apologize. You know, I talk a lot about how much of a financial struggle it is to keep all of this on the air. And no, I'm not going into that right now. But sometimes you get emails that really do make it all worthwhile. And I got one of those the other night. And I'm going to find it here in a second. I sincerely hope that it is still here. It came in, gosh, I guess it was Tuesday night, which means that I must have, I'll find it yet. But truly, it is one of those things that makes this all worth doing, because every now and then, one of y'all will reach out and just say these amazing, beautiful, inspiring things that make getting behind the microphone an absolute joy. And I am looking for it now, and I can't find it, which is very frustrating to me. Try one more page. Darn. I remember the name. And one of the things I think I found out about my email is that if I delete an email on my phone, I think I delete it everywhere, which means I got to go in and fool around with the settings. But it was from an individual in Poughkeepsie, New York. And he said, "You just keep saying all the stuff that I've been thinking all along, and it means so much to have the horn to help me hang on to my sanity, basically." And I'm entirely paraphrasing at this point. And moments like that make all of this more than worthwhile. Because it's so special to know that this means that to you all. And it needs to be said that the feeling is mutual. Because I can't get any of this by turning on my TV or my radio. I can't get the information that you bring me. And as such, I rely on you to the same extent that you you count on this program being there. And for that, I stand in constant amazement and gratitude. Hey, welcome to the program.
Well, gonzo greetings. I'm glad everything went well for Agnes.
Well, thank you, Spike. It did.
Also, I'd like to just say, starting off, that while you don't have to do a sales pitch to ask for money at the moment, there's definitely always a lot of love for the horn out there, even in small contributions, because two listeners of the horn agreed to go half on paying for an ad in the journal for the Democratic Party's banquet coming up here in Monroe County, Pennsylvania, which is part of the congressional district for Kanjorski and Lou Barletta, most notably. And so even if sometimes it isn't directly to the horn, there's still some charitable given to support the horn elsewhere and promote the horn out here, where I suspect a lot of people who don't like Lou Barletta might really enjoy the horn. So it's kind of a great demographic, to use one of those catchphrases, to go after, to try to attract more listeners who in turn would become potentially more supporters for the horn.
I think that's just neat as can be.
Yeah, yeah. So I tried to find a few groups that I support that I could get to come kind of support us here for things like that. I also, it looks like the one ahead with an organization called the Liberal Gun Club agreed to buy an ad as well, which is good because there's going to be a lot of NRA money going into Lou Barletta, so why not get my club, which is the exact opposite of the NRA, where rational members belong. To kind of counteract a little bit of the myths, fear-mongering, and lying that the NRA is just so notably behind all the time. By the way, I might add, with the Kagan hearings, the NRA essentially sent out a little secret inter-office memo that was somewhat leaked on the Internet for everyone that's high up in the NRA. Keep your mouth shut during the Kagan thing, because her record could clearly debunk that there's no effort to take anyone's guns away. She doesn't have an all entirely anti-Second Amendment record at all, and they knew if they opened their mouths, that would be mentioned, and of course, that would make their fear-mongering of you're about to lose your guns start to go away. Because really, this administration has no interest in doing anything like that. As a matter of fact, a lot of major things have changed in favor of that side with Obama in office. So it's good to keep the fear in the minds of these people, this false reality that they've created that he's going to take their guns, when in all actuality, he has no interest whatsoever in even touching them.
No, no, and yet, let's just face facts, Spike. Barack Obama's been the best thing that ever happened to the American gun industry, because they're selling guns faster and bullets more and faster than they've ever sold them before. All on nothing but a phonied up, dummied up, ginned up, rubed up, Carnival Midway the con scheme that has no basis in reality.
Right, right. He's going to take them. Well, just like, because I grew up with guns, so maybe a lot of liberals out there are cringing when I say that. I'm a liberal with a gun collection. Not a large one, but just a few.
Mine used to be considerably larger, but it's down to the basics: rifle, shotgun, a couple of handguns.
Yeah. Right now, I only have long guns. I have no handguns, even though apparently I'm better at shooting handguns. My father's old shotgun, which was converted between you could do for birds or with slugs for deer season, and I have a single shotgun, a little .22 long rifle. Nothing too spectacular, but nonetheless, I have them. Once in a while, they get used. What kills me is these myths and things they try to doctor up as everything's a conspiracy to take your guns. Right now, because I get certain publications that I read, the big and websites and things like that, I see the biggest thing they're pushing is this EPA, this. Doctored up a bit story of the EPA is trying to outlaw the use of, and by the way, they're saying how there's little evidence to prove that if you take the lead out of ammunition, that the lead's causing any pollution to the woods and conservation, which, first of all, it's both hard to prove and disprove something like that because of all the variables and trying to find where there might be a heavy concentration of bullets fired in.
Yeah, but the fact of the matter is, lead is toxic even when it's not moving at 1,000 feet per second.
Right. Well, actually, my point exactly is it would behoove firearm owners to do away with lead bullets.
And you know what? You know what sucks? You know, I mean, if we're going to talk gun guy hunter to gun guy hunter, you know what sucks? Going out pheasant hunting, and you know they call it wing shooting because you're supposed to take them down by the wing. You're not supposed to blow. You're not supposed to blow the guts out of them from the back to the front. You know, you don't gut them on the wing with a 12 gauge and 4 shot. But that happens sometimes, and I remember a long time ago sitting down to a big dinner. I had cooked it. We'd gone out pheasant hunting, and oh, they were good. It was pheasant served with an apple, onion, juniper essence dressing stuffing. And the pheasants themselves, you know, you can't really eat the legs, too much tan, you know, the little running bastards. And but it was the breast, and we wrapped the breast in bacon and slow roast. Oh God, it was good. And I was cruising through one, you know, it got me. Oh, it hurts, because I had just bitten down with all the force of my mouth, which, you know, human beings have some substantial foot pounds of pressure in their jaws, and just chomped right down on a piece of 4 shot.
Yeah, it doesn't, and that's not.
Oh, that sucks.
Especially if you have a fillin in your.
Oh no, this one. No, I ground right down on it with a crown.
Yeah, yeah. So it would be behoof firearm owner, because I got my varsity letter and rifle team, and I shot a ton of my teenage years of .22 long rifle. Those are just lead bullet heads. They're not even like the bigger ammo where they put copper around the lead.
No, not even jacketed. Yeah, no, I remember one of my PE credits in college was for rifle range.
Right, and our range was older and didn't have the best ventilation. And needless to say, I'd always, if you shoot a lot of .22, especially with all that lead, you have this like kind of dirt feeling in your mouth afterwards from basically the fumes of what you just shot. And don't you know, shortly after high school, I had a lot of problems with my lungs, and it turned out I had asthma. I always got bronchitis as a kid and things like that. It probably didn't help. I spent 4 years breathing lead fumes Monday through Friday in the winter.
I love the smell of cordite in the morning.
But, you know, and for that matter, if you just handle a lot of unjacketed lead bullets, you just get that lead dust all over your hand. Anyone who, especially these people who are into competition shooting and shoot frequently or go hunting all the time, the worst thing you'd want is to handle all that lead, because when I worked on a race team and we used back in the day, in those days, and they probably still do in NASCAR because they're so backwards at times, lead weights in the frame rails of a stock car for putting the weights on through it all. Sometimes you'd have to cut them, and it doesn't matter what team you're with, anytime someone would have to do it, they'd always tell people that had to be nearby them as they do it, try to hold your breath as I do it, because you don't want to breathe the fumes of this. It's lead. So why would you want to breathe the fumes of it when you fire it with gunpowder, which I've never understood? And by the way, you know, everyone talks about, well, you know, lead, you can use it for the expansion, the handgun rounds. Let me tell you something. A full metal jacket round will F you up pretty good, just as much as an expansion round. And trust me, the military has been taking people down for quite some time with full metal jacket bullets, since you can't use expansion bullets and, you know,
hollow points,
very
and
soft bullets in military, because it's against, I do believe, it's the Geneva Convention. I could be wrong about the specific place in international law where that.
Of course, that's not to say that soldiers in the field don't modify their ammo with a little downtime around.
That's potentially could be the case as well. But at least they're not allowed to have it officially issued to them in that manner.
Correct.
And on to one last point while I keep on the firearms issue for the night, is, you know, we had that taxi cab driver who was just attacked in New York City because of...
Are you a Muslim? Consider this a checkpoint.
Right. And then
turns out dude was drunk.
Peace be to God.
Yeah.
He was what? Say that again?
Yeah, dude was drunk too.
Well, yeah, that doesn't help. Although I think the one that peed in the carpet of the mosque in Brooklyn was perfectly sober when he did his attack.
Oh, most likely. But you know, it's not just New York. This thing happened out in California. The Madera Islamic Center, a story reported through the Fresno Bee. A brick was put through the window, and repeatedly signs have been placed on the mosque saying things like, "No temple for the god of terrorism at ground zero." And it was signed ANB, which stands for American Nationalist Brotherhood.
Well, that is close to where Michael Savage bases his show out of, so perhaps it's one of his... I believe a lot of these people are some of his fans, and Beck's fans especially, that are out there getting very foamed at the mouth over it. And we also have people like Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann even using phrases of reload, lock and loaded, you know...
Yeah, Don't resign, Dr. Laura. Reload.
And then you got Michelle Bachmann in Minnesota saying, you know, I want people locked and loaded over this cap and trade. Nutbags.
Yeah.
And they wonder why people run around slashing people with knives and shooting up the place. And therefore Michelle Malkin, the original anchor baby, has to get on Fox, well, Radio Rwanda, and complain about people pointing out the fact that these right-wing hate mongers are in fact accessories before the fact to the commission of felonies. But one of the problems that exists is that this Michael Enright, allegedly the slasher, he's 21 years old. He just looks like a Republican. And the problem is they won't go to his house. They won't ask around. They won't say what kind of TV does he watch? What kind of books does he read? What kind of radio does he listen to? Because there's some sort of hands-off policy in America that we want to just assume that anybody who acts like a right-winger is engaging in manifestations of mental illness, when in fact they're just manifesting the marching orders that they've been given, Spike.
Yeah, and that's precisely my biggest fear coming up is we have the election coming up. And, you know, they've made it clear since Obama took office that a lot of them really want to promote the idea that they're armed and angry. And my biggest concern is most polling places, the quote-unquote security put in place is unarmed. And I see a potential that we could have one, if not numerous, election day massacres by a crazed armed right winger.
I don't think that's out of hand at all. And of course, he did this slash job with the little knife, and I'm sure you've seen him before. You know what a Leatherman is, right?
Yes.
Well, they didn't find the weapon, but they found his Leatherman pouch in the cab. And you mentioned the NRA not attacking Elena Kagan. I wonder, because I always think about these little PR flacks working in little offices like the NRA headquarters there that sits hard by I-66 going out of Washington, D.C., or going into Washington, D.C. And I wonder if there's a little PR flack that's sort of, you know, scratching his pointy little head and thinking, you know what? He committed that crime with a knife. How can we use this to the NRA's advantage?
Yeah. Yeah, no bullets, no shots were fired.
Right, and what's the argument? If only that Muslim cab driver had been armed. No, I don't think that's going to work with our membership. When all Leatherman tools are outlawed, only outlaws will have Leatherman tools. Nah, it's too big to get on a bumper sticker.
You can have my Leatherman when you pry it from my cold dead hand.
There's that one.
Actually, they go for slogans that are quite long on bumper stickers. That's actually their specialty. Is bumper stickers that you have to be right up on someone's ass to actually be able to read them are almost a trademark of the NRA.
Our founding fathers put their lives on the line, their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor so that we could have Leatherman tools to slash the necks of Muslim cabbies. There we go. There's one, Spike.
Get another one of them Arabs. That would probably be a slogan they would want to use, too. But I just would almost beg that anyone out there who's a Democrat who has a concealed carry permit, this might be a good year to volunteer at a poll, just as long as you're a responsible individual who knows the proper time of a potentially one to have to draw. Because I just see a few lunatics showing up election day this year looking for an easy fish in a barrel. And, I mean, it's pretty clear the right-wing talk machine is encouraging them to become more violent and more prejudiced and just more out of control.
Oh, I'm actually worried. What's going to happen on Saturday when all those weird little teabagging freaks show up in whatever number in Washington, D.C., and run across the counter rally being hosted or formed or sponsored or organized by the Reverend Al Sharpton?
Oh, I'm sure there'll be some racism.
Because, see, there's
be smart enough to have the cameras rolling.
Well, I just hope somebody's there taking pictures of the signs that the teabaggers are carrying.
Oh, well, you know, and the thing is that'll have what looks to be a semi-decent-sized crowd showing up for it, because I was talking about this earlier today since I've been down there recently. You know, Lynchburg, Virginia isn't that far of a drive. That's real crazy Virginia. Those are the people who think, you know, a lot of what Jerry Falwell said made sense. These would be the people most likely to show up to a Beck thing. By the way, debunking the fact he's a libertarian, because any real true libertarian, while they might be a true right winger when it comes to financial issues of the matter with taxes and such, when it comes to social issues, they'll be nowhere near the same league as a Jerry Falwell. Trust me, Jesse Ventura has nothing in common when it comes to social policies as a Jerry Falwell follower or someone from Liberty University. Let's be really real about that. And the big myth he likes to put out there. I'm a libertarian. No, you're a jackass.
Yep. For Spike.
So it won't be too hard for them to bust in a huge number of crazed Baptists. Because like I said, it isn't that, you know, having recently driven down, I know now from driving down there, it's not that bad of a drive.
No, it's an easy ride.
So I think they might be a distorted look. People will look and they'll see a large crowd and go, oh, wow, he's really got something going. No, he picked that location specifically because they knew it would be easy to bust in nitwits who believe in him. If they tried to do this in New York City, yeah, forget about it. He'd have probably more counter-protesters than supporters in attendance. If he tried this in Philadelphia,
oh, this may get, well, but this may be problematic anyway, because he's already been pushed into a corner, Beck has, of arguing that, Republicans don't own Abraham Lincoln. The Democrats don't own Dr. King. He's there for all of us. I wasn't even thinking about Dr. King's speech when I scheduled this for August the 28th, but I think the divine hand of providence is in it.
Well,
Wears magic underwear, please.
Dr. King was a democratic socialist. Just imagine if he was alive today, what Glenn Beck would say about him.
Well, remember that Black Republican Association or Association of Black Republicans or whatever a few years back had those billboards that said Dr. King was a registered Republican. Beautiful thing.
Well,
hey, Spike, I got to roll on. I got to hit a couple more calls, but great stuff, man. Great stuff.
Have a good one, and
stay away from the lead when it's being sliced, okay?
I will try.
All right, we'll see you, Spike. Bye now. Our good buddy Spike from up in the northeastern part of Pennsylvania. Hey, welcome to the program.
Am I on?
You are on.
Okay, Bob.
Is that Sparky?
Yes, I'm testing out new technology.
Awesome, awesome.
The Gmail has a call box now.
Wow, I'm looking in mine. I don't see it, but
kind of like, well, if you've got the chat thing,
yeah,
there's a program you have to download to get it to work. But till the end of the year, the calls are free, U.S. and Canada.
Wow.
I don't know where to begin after following Spike and Jim, but there's so much information. Are you talking about the Leathermans?
Yeah.
I was listening to the Bob and Elvis show today. You know, Bob Sirk.
Yeah, they do a great job. I wish it was more than one or two days a week.
It's only on Thursdays.
Yeah, one day a week.
And they're sponsored by the Bubble Ladies you met at.
Oh, Bubble Genius, yeah. Aren't they wonderful?
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, they were doing the Do Not Bring list for the Glenn Beck rally. And no signs, no Leathermans, no, they said no stakes, no tents, no I'm trying to think of everything. It was just like, no, nothing. You can't bring anything, just your body in a bottle of water, I guess.
Well, God knows they don't want the signs because they've had enough trouble as it is with those. You don't want the illiterate teabaggers out there expressing themselves because they tend not to do it very well or grammatically or properly spelled. You know, it's tough when you're a racist and you can't spell because then you're not just a racist, you're a racist idiot.
But backing up to what my original thought for today was, you know, you're talking about those fly ash impoundments and the coal waste dams and shit. You know that project I worked on last year from the copper mines?
Yeah.
It was one of the most toxic EPA sites in the country. Well, it's finished up a month or two ago. They finally sucked all the crap that was in the river, the sediment that was in the river, pumped it up several miles and put it in a big dugout lined with plastic and rock containment area and capped it. It's all done now. But the dam where that came down from the mine, they don't expect any more toxic waste to get down there because a few years before that, at the mine site itself, they had to put in a treatment plant to treat all the stuff that flew down the hill that went into the dam. But this was just the residue from over 50 years ago and 100 years ago when the copper mines were going great that polluted the rivers and streams. But the sludge is just as toxic as what you're talking about. The lake where there's still sludge in the lake, you drive by it, there's a sign that says there's no swimming, there's no fish in this water. But you drive by it and you look at it, and during the day in the heat of the summer, it heats up, and there's all these oxygen bubbles that comes to the surface from the stuff decomposing on the bottom, creating gas. But it looks like fish surfacing.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, you think about it. I mean, you got all those containment areas. I mean, 50, 100 years from now, your grandkids are going to have to deal with them. If you ever get off coal.
That's, well, we've got some, and this is all grasshopper versus the ant stuff, Spark. We're not beginning to think about a tenth of the stuff that we have to consider from what our reliance on coal for the last 125 years has meant to the toxic nature of this country. And that's what I was talking to Jim about. You know, sooner or later, we have to re-engage with the future. We have to think past our grandchildren. We have to think not even generationally, but in terms of centuries. Because what happens to one of those toxic waste sludge impoundments 500 years from now? Who's prepared to say what the culture will look like then? Is Massey so sure? Someday the technology will come along to vaporize it and transport it to beta reticuli, that they're willing to just let it sit there? Or is it a matter of they don't much care because, like George Bush said when somebody asked him how history would view him, well, I don't know and I don't much care because we'll all be dead then. I think it's the latter, not the former.
I think I told you the main reason for cleaning up that sludge in the river was it's the outlet of a hydroelectric plant. And they could only put out so much water before they disturbed that stuff and cause it to go down the river and kill more fish. So now they can increase the water flow. It's part of the Central Valley Project. It's like the TVA. You know, we have Shasta Dam and we have Trinity Dam. It's part of this project, they generate water there, and they send water down through the mountains, through tubes, to Whiskeytown Dam, and they generate power at Car Powerhouse at Whiskeytown Dam. And then they take the water out of Whiskeytown Dam, they put it through Spring Creek Powerhouse, which is the one that was going to blow the stuff into the toxic waste, and then they send it over Keswick Dam, which is right there also. So they use the same water and you generate power four times.
Not a bad idea in the long run, but
No, but this was thought out back in the 50s and 60s.
Again, in an era when we were trying to think transgenerationally.
Mm-hmm. But one of the other reasons, I mean, we've spent so much money, the government spent so much money trying to recover the salmon runs in the Sacramento River. You know about those.
Yeah.
You can't fish for salmon in the Sacramento River anymore. The runs are quarantined. Whatever runs up the river to the hatchery that's down below us runs up the hatchery, and you can't catch any of them because of the runs got so low out in the ocean because of the oxygen level in the ocean's killing something's happening out in the ocean. It's making the runs low, and all along California coast, and I think all the way up to Washington, you can't fish for Pacific Coast salmon anymore. They can still get them in Alaska, but not out here on the Pacific Coast. Something's happening.
Well, it's like that story I read a couple of weeks back that said they haven't had an oyster harvest up along the Pacific Coast in Washington in 6 years. Yeah, that should be a beyond the fact that I love oysters on the half shell. That should just be a great big blinking signpost of oh hell. Because when life won't, when the sea won't support that life, it's pretty sure that somewhere along the way it'll stop supporting most of everything else. Sparky, I'm glad the Gmail talk worked, and we will talk soon.
Okay. Oh, did you ever get your gremlin? Find your gremlin?
No,
electrical system.
He's behaving. I don't know. He's gone to ground. Haha, ground. Electricity pun.
Not acting up.
Yeah, he's behaving himself for the time being, but. He still needs chasing. I think it's what you described. I've just got to finish the job.
Okay. Well, take care. Give her best to the family.
All right. Thanks, Sparky.
All right.
Bye now.
Night.
Sparky calling from California and also has served as a remote electricity consultant for me here.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, Juanita.
I just had a few things to say. I'm so glad about Agnes. She finally got her surgery.
Yes.
Bless her heart. And you tell her, I said, to please take care of herself.
Well, I will. And maybe she'll take that better coming from you than from me.
Well,
hey, honey, Juanita said don't make her come up here.
Well, the thing is that, she's got to take time, a month or so, and take care of herself so she can have a better life, and it'll be better for everybody. You just should take care of yourself.
Absolutely.
And also I wanted to say about Brian. Brian, I prayed for your doggie, and I believe that he's in heaven. I don't care what Pat Robertson said. Pat Robertson said there's no animals in heaven. I think he's full of baloney. And last church I went to was, all of a sudden it dawned on me, that years ago when I was working when my son was small and I just didn't think I was going to make it. And I thought, well, I'll just live in my car. And I thought, well, me and my son, we could live in the car. I really believed it. but we had this kitty cat. And I kept thinking, what's going to happen to him? And so anyway, it just dawned on me, I was in church, and I thought, he might have been an angel, because God knew I couldn't go out and live in the car. it's just so hard to pay your place, pay on your place and everything else. But anyway, I got up in church, and I said, I think my cat was an angel. They looked at me like I was crazy. But I didn't care because I really thought that.
And who are they to dispute it?
Well, I could have misread it, but I'm sure some of them did. I'm sure maybe not all of them, but maybe some of them did.
But I don't understand. First of all, I don't think heaven is manifested the way that it says in the book. Those people were semi-barbaric, barely literate. and they just wanted to describe a place where their souls would go that wasn't dirty and filthy and covered in sand.
Well, I feel like that.
But you know, I don't want to. Who would? I mean, if heaven is what they say it is, who would want to live in? What kind of heaven is it when you don't have a dog to scratch behind the ears or a cat to curl up on your lap?
Well, look at Revelation about talking about the horses and all. I mean, that was Pat Robertson. You know, he's got an answer for everything, and that's it. Oh no, there won't be any. They don't have a soul. Well, I'm telling you, these animals, they all got their own personality. They're all different. Even though they're the same species, they're all different. And, you know, I agree, you know, just like the story, you know, of Lazarus, the rich man, where Lazarus was covered with sores, and the only friend he had was the dog. And he ate crumbs from the rich man's table. Remember that
one? Oh, my God, it's Reaganomics.
Yeah, trickle down. Slavery, trickle down. Yeah, trickle down economics, yeah. That's slavery. All those people, they're so happy.
See, they keep reading these things and they don't draw the lessons from them they're supposed to get.
Right. And then you were talking, somebody was talking about Al Capone. You know, Al Capone, he fed the poor people.
Sure.
He has soup lines. And, I mean, how much worse was he than some of these people running these organizations and some of these people that are in government?
That's, or you know, how much worse was he than, you know, some 2010 corporate predator?
Yeah, absolutely. And you read about,
you know, it's the difference between, and again, working the theme of the evening. It's the difference between being faced with a guy who's got a gun pointed at you and looking at a guy who's smiling in your face at the same time he's feeding you poison.
And another thing, though, this is my interpretation. It is in the Bible about what Jesus said about, he told the religious leaders of the day that the harlots and the publicans would go into the kingdom of heaven before they would. And of course, you know, they didn't like that.
No, not a bit.
It was supposed to be the low life, and you know, they was accusing him of hanging around with the sinners, you know. And in my mind, there's a lot of people that don't call themselves anything. You know, they don't call themselves Christian, whatever, you know.
Well, as long as Pat Robertson and Franklin Graham are running around out there, why would you want to be associated with those?
You know what's bad about that? About that? About them talking about the Muslim? Muslim. I saw the guy say it's Muslim. he was a Muslim. He was talking on C-SPAN. But anyway, what's bad is these people that are ignorant about things. They think that. Like now, you know, they're protesting the Sikhs. They're wanting to build a place. Well, see, I had a Sikh doctor when 9/11 fell. And I had talked to him because I'm always curious about religions, other religions and everything. And he told me a lot about their religion because I thought they were connected either with Mohammedism or Hinduism, and you know,
neither of the above, and they're quite.
They're very different. They're neither one, and yet after 9/11, you know, I asked him had he had any problems because they killed a Sikh down here after 9/11, and he said, "Oh yeah," he said, "I have to be careful," and I just told him I was sorry, I apologized for the ignorance of people's ignorance, but. See, that's the problem with this thing, you know. And I saw a woman that, I believe it was on Keith Olbermann's show, where she lost a daughter who was pregnant and a son and all, and I believe, and she's getting out now. You know, she's getting with the people. She said that for her sanity, you know, she had to have peace about it and to know that these people were the same as they were. And I don't know, you know, They play people. They love to stir up problems. And like Glenn Beck, you know, he's claiming there's going to be miracles up. He's going to have miracles. Well, I'm telling you, I don't think the God that he's talking about, talking to him, I don't think it's the God that I've come to know a little bit about.
Indeed, indeed.
But maybe that's all I had to say. It seemed like I had something else, but.
Well, you know what? You might find. Just go to.
I know what I want to talk about. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, go to Wikipedia and read up on Sikhism.
Yes.
You'll find it fascinating.
Yeah, it is fascinating.
I've read some in their holy book, and that is equally fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had a good friend from Iran. They had to escape from over there when the Shah, you know, when the Ayatollah came in, because they were Bahaya. And the Ayatollah was hanging the Bahayans, men and women and children.
Right.
And they escaped, came over here. And she was a darling. I just adored her. And they were Bahayan. But what I wanted to say was, you were talking about last night something to me about Alan Grayson. I just wanted to tell you that, you know, he didn't have a Democratic opponent.
Right, right.
But now he does have an opponent. And, of course, I read this newspaper article, and they said, he's going to meet his match, you know. And this guy, I think his name is Daniels, but guess who he's supported by? Jeb Bush and Huckabee.
Well, of course.
Well, I'm glad that
the apple falleth not far from the tree.
Right. And McCollum, I'm glad he lost.
I am too, but you know what? I do love a sore loser, especially when he's a Republican. He put out a statement saying, I still have serious questions about Rick Scott, about issues with his character, his integrity, his honesty, things that go back to Columbia HCA, and I have not had the occasion to really even get acquainted with them.
About his own?
Well, there you go. Physician, heal thyself. But in this case, I'm willing. But in this case, Juanita, I'm willing for him to continue to be blinded by the beam in his own eye and continue to complain about the moat in Rick Scott's, because the moat in Rick Scott's is really, really big.
Well, you know, the one difference of him, he was supported also by Jeb Bush, McCollum. And for that one thing, I'm glad.
Yeah, and I hope that he can be defeated, Rick Scott.
Rick, he gets beat.
You know, he went from managing fast food chains to managing hospitals, and he did it with the same kind of
approach. Oh, I found
approach.
Out he's got those clinics in Walmart. I don't know if he's got all of them. That's another thing he's involved in.
Kidney dialysis on aisle 12. Yeah. Juanita, have a wonderful night.
Okay. You too, and night-night.
All right, thanks. Bye now. And let's see if this person is still here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob.
Sandra.
Hey, listen, so you were talking about, you know, the coal ash, and just, it's just so overwhelming. But, of course, it reminded me of, have you ever read... Rebecca Harding Davis.
Seems like I have, but I can't pull up a title of it.
She wrote Life in the Iron Mills. It was sort of a
punk. Yes, yeah. Oh, yes, yes, yes. She I'm sorry. You had to give me a title first. She revolutionized realism in American literature.
Exactly. Yeah, that was her. Yeah.
And she came from where?
Ohio.
West Virginia.
Was she?
Yep, Wheeling.
Yeah, they moved to Ohio, that's right then. Well, the thing about her, it's just sort of, you know, the type of writing was just sort of startling for the sort of reading public at that time, because she talked about, you know, women working, and they weren't the kind of stories that Dickens had come across. You know,
and Dickens was brutal, but
but still was nowhere near as real.
No,
even as this woman's stuff, and I don't know. And it's the 19th century, and it's like more and more the 19th century keeps coming back at me. And you know, I'm so grateful that I was able to take this class on American literature from that period, because there's so much of it, and it's just so revealing. You know, the 19th century was sort of an amazing time in this country, but the fact that we're reverting is what's really disturbing to me. But anyway, she just popped in my mind when I was listening to your conversation this evening.
Well, I'm so glad that she did, because, like I said, it took me a minute to pick up the name, but she's incredibly important because, among other things, she changed the mind of... She was one of, if not the first, women to be published in the Atlantic.
Well, yeah, that's where this story first appeared, and she submitted it anonymously initially, because the powers that be were kind of concerned about, you know, her sex. But eventually, you know...
Well, one of those Boston Brahmins had declared that writing was not the fit province of the female.
Well, yeah, and you know...
And she turned him. I forget which one it was, but, yeah.
Yeah, so did, like, Fanny Fern did the same thing to Hawthorne. He was also very anti-women writing, but he gave her the nod, which was pretty incredible on his part, because, like all men of that era, you know, women really were sort of, no. But Fanny Fern was another writer that is also one of my favorites. I think I mentioned her to you before. But, yeah, anyway, you know, that was the only thing that popped in my mind. But I was just wondering, have you heard about the government's right to sort of put this GPS device on your car? It came out the Ninth Circuit.
No.
Yeah, and, it's, you know, the Ninth Circuit is always getting some sort of praise, but they said that it's okay for the state of California to put a GPS device on your car because it doesn't violate your Fourth Amendment right, because you don't have any reasonable expectations of privacy in your own driveway.
You know, that's so scary in so many ways, because, you know, there's all that legal stuff out there about the difference between an illegal search of your home and an illegal search of the curtilage and of outbuildings.
Right, but the other problem with this, and it's interesting because one of the judges that dissented was some sort of, you know, known conservative who said, oh, yeah, but the only people who aren't subjected to this are rich people, because their driveways are, I mean, it's brutal. Their driveways are protected, so he can't just rummage. But for the rest of us, you know, the government can just sort of rummage in the middle of the night and do what they will. And it's just sort of like, and this, on top of L.A. plans to use a watered-down version of the laser beam on L.A. County Jail inmates. The military device that they point at people and it makes you feel like you're burning?
Oh, lovely. Yeah, the mic. Yeah, what's that, active denial or something like that? Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, once again, that sort of technology has sort of trickled down into domestic policing. So now they're going to be using this on people.
We kind of knew that was going to happen, didn't we?
Well, yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it's just sort of, you know, I'm just scared of that. But, I don't know. You know, you got to get all these sort of unemployed nobodies, get ready to get them in line.
Yeah, I know. And the right-wingers were so scared it was just white people in general that were going to be rounded up by Obama. Poor fools.
Please. I know your time's up, but Agnes is doing okay, right?
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
But the question I have is, well, is the surgery? Is she feeling better because of the procedure?
Yes, that's the thing. Okay. She said when she began to be coherent that she could already tell a profound difference.
Right, because you know, we all like to bag on the healthcare system, but you know, one would like to think that when you're being subjected to it, you want to have a positive outcome. Like,
yeah, not just not dying. That's not right. Enough.
Right. Just have the problem addressed. So I'm glad to hear that.
Well, I will tell her. She says, she has said thus far that even walking around, she feels different.
That's
a net positive on the whole, because this is the stuff that has given her fits, given her problems. I don't mean fits, but has given her profound problems for a lot of years.
I mean, it's nothing better than having some sort of chronic ailment resolved. It's like being reborn. So, you know, I'm glad that's worked out for her. And, you know, I'll let you go. I'm sure you need to go away.
Yeah. Sandra, we'll talk soon. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye now. And I do, in fact, have to go away, as it were. We're slap out of time. It's coming up on 3 minutes past the hour. I want to thank everybody who contributed this evening. Wonderful conversations and good emails and a wonderful chat going on in the chat room. Nice busy room this evening. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for your continued financial support of the Horn. We find ourselves with, 5 days left in the month and $1,000 away from our monthly goal. Any help would be much appreciated. The PayPal button or snail mail makes no difference. I'll be back tomorrow night. Tomorrow is Friday, isn't it? Yeah, Friday on the front porch. So I hope you'll join me as well. In the meantime, have a wonderful evening or a great day whenever it is you're listening to the program. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this go. Lottie in the chat room, our news ninjas Gene and Susan, our blogger Texas Betsy, Matt Osborne, osborneinc.com, Reverbo, our cavalcade of crazy op-ed, columnist at headonradionetwork.com. My head writer is David in Tennessee. John Fox is our chief engineer down in Australia. He's also our webmaster, web designer. Awesome host in his own right. And we'll get all Foxed up back on the air one of these days, somehow or another. Also, of course, thanks always go out to the hardest working man in liberal talk. That's Ben Birch at WhiteRoseSociety.org. WhiteRoseSociety.org. And, of course, the program is always brought to you with the additional help of Coal River Mountain Watch, the hardest working, bravest people I know. And they are a big part of what's going on with Appalachia Rising, appalacharising.org, happening in Washington, D.C., beginning the 25th of September. A little less than a month away now. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
Conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy!
And welcome to the program. It's a little more than a minute past the hour. I'm Bob. This is The Horn. And sorry for missing prayer meeting, but you know what? I was busy. But I have good news. For those of you who didn't catch the tweets or the Facebooking, Agnes got through the surgery just fine, and she is home. Brought her home earlier today. She is on industrial strength pain medication. She is uncomfortable, but she's home and happy to be here. And especially tickled and pleased and warmed in the heart by all the good wishes that all of you sent along. The Facebook page got pretty doggone long, and that's awfully nice of you. And thanks for the emails and kind wishes that way. Thanks for the phone calls and the kind wishes we've received there. Thanks to the two of you, who you know who you are, who sent flowers. See, Agnes puts forward this rough and tumble and take no prisoners kind of personality attitude. But like I've warned you before, she's a marshmallow. And flowers? Oh, flowers are kryptonite to Agnes's mean streak. So when the flowers arrived today, suffice to say, she wept. She'll kill me if she hears me saying that. But she did. She wept. So thank you, all of you. Your kindness and your good wishes made all of this a lot less of an unpleasant experience for her than it otherwise would have done. And you know what? That matters. I know, you know, we don't all adhere to any particular holy book, but I think a lot of us do take to heart the common sense that many of the sacred texts around the world, focused as they are on various and sundry imaginary beings, manage to eke out. And there's no magic involved when the guy who said, love your neighbor as yourself, and got murdered by the state for it, they said, what is the greatest commandment? And he said, love God with all your heart. And what's the second commandment? And Jesus made up a wholly new commandment that wasn't even in the list. He said, love your neighbor as yourself. So later on, when he's giving the speech about the fact that, I was in prison and you visited me. I was hungry and you fed me. I was naked and you clothed me. And if you've done that to the least of these, you've done it also unto me. That's common sense.